Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Simple and delicious, the new Southern Style Chicken Biscuit for breakfast and the Southern Style Chicken Sandwich for lunch or dinner. McDonald's.
The Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Joining me, Jalene Jordan in the studio. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, good evening,
and
Peter.
Bong hits for Jesus to you.
Yes, and that was on the T-shirt, right?
I didn't think we were going to get into this. No,
you have to explain why we say something like that at the beginning of a show.
I thought you would return the greeting.
Well, of course I return the greeting.
Bong hits for Jesus.
Okay.
Bong hits for Jesus was the banner that all these high school students were carrying in Alaska. And this far-right-wing Supreme Court, mm-hmm. thanks to George W. Bush,
yes.
held that the principal was within her rights to confiscate the banner, even though these kids were on public property. And they said they did it as a joke, this meaningless
yes.
phrase,
right.
bong
I mean,
hits for Jesus.
Yeah.
What in the hell does that mean? But that's not where I want to go.
We're a bizarre show. Why not start yes. out that way?
You could start by dialing us up at 313-298-WRIF. We'll get you on the air with your opinion. 313-298-9743. For the bashful or those that can't get through, call talkyes@yahoo.com. Short remarks, please, and I may read them on the air, or Jalene may as well.
Yeah, if they're really long, Peter gets instantly overwhelmed. He goes, oh, that's too much.
Well, you can't.
We only have a four-minute
what?
Commercial break in which to read those
yeah,
emails.
You can't edit them.
Right.
Right. Well, I saw Sicko on Saturday night.
Sicko, which is the Michael Moore documentary.
About healthcare in America. And
Tell us.
You know, I talked to some friends. Actually, right before we went, we had dinner at these people's house who had seen it the night before, the opening night in Detroit, and they said they were really disappointed because they thought it was going to be boffo at the box office, and they said the theater was about half filled.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I said, I didn't go opening night because I thought it would be...
Everyone thought that way, probably,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. S-O-R, right? Or S-R, yeah, S-R-O. S-R-O.
S-O-L?
No. No, S-R-O, standing room only.
All right.
So, so nobody showed up the first night, but it was really jammed at the Birmingham 8.
Ooh.
And it is a very, very well-done documentary. Michael is in it less than any of his other films, although
okay.
he certainly makes some appearances. It has been universally lauded for its cinematic qualities, although people have, as usual, taken some objection to both its... What? It's all
well,
of a sudden.
Is the right saying it's all propaganda, just like the other?
Yeah,
like
actually,
you know, 9/11.
There's something wrong with Yahoo News.
Columbine.
Sometimes it doesn't print. You know, it cuts off the right side. But I printed out this article. Moore's Sicko gives accused little say. And Linda Johnson, Associated Press writer, is saying that they didn't allow the CEOs of the HMOs and the health insurance companies and what have you, the doctors, to have any say. It was all one-sided.
You know what? They probably didn't want to. They probably refused to be interviewed.
Yeah,
don't you think?
Well, not only you don't have to think. If you go to michaelmoore.com, you can find these documents that the industry that profits to hundreds of billions of dollars, they get rich, or the other way around. We get sick, they get rich, right? What's
okay.
wrong with this equation? The sicker we get, the richer they get. There is something definitely amiss here, and Michael shows it so well, just absolutely so well.
But, all right. Well, I need to go see it.
Yeah, well, they're nitpicking, as they did with Roger and Me, mm-hmm. and Bowling for Columbine,
right, and Fahrenheit 9/11.
And are there little flaws in it? I'm sure. But overall, the overall thesis of each one of them is absolutely correct. And the fact that the United States, the wealthiest country in the world, is ranked 37th in the world in terms of health care is just incredible.
Well, it's pathetic.
Yeah, it's absolutely pathetic. The only reason we're 37th is because there's a privileged sector, people like me, that gets absolutely wonderful health care because
right.
of how I'm positioned.
True.
And this is unnecessary, and it certainly is horrifying when you learn what people are denied, the health consequences and the financial consequences. I was talking to a friend of mine, someone you know, who's a woman who said she cried almost all the way through it.
Oh, well, that'll be me. I can predict it already.
And I said I was fighting back tears at a number of occasions, and she said, "Why the hell would you just cry?" And I said, "I'm a man, M-A-N. Let me say it again.
Man up.
Man up, yeah, yeah." So they're complaining that the doctors, drug makers, hospitals, and insurers charged with greed and putting personal interest, corporate interest. So they're making hundreds of billions of dollars, and this is, on the other hand, patients and doctors from Canada, Britain, France, and Cuba marvel at their health care. Well, duh, it's all free.
Yes.
And there's a great scene. I know people, he can't believe, he's playing at this. Michael Moore is playing in Sicko, that he can't believe that everything is free in hospitals in Britain. And so he finally goes down to the basement and he finds a cashier's window and he says, "Aha!" That he's finally discovered they have to pay
some. There is a money system.
There is, except the hospital is giving people money.
Right.
Because when they come out of a hospital stay and they don't have any money, they grant them.
Well, isn't that a crazy concept?
Now, this Morris Sicko gives a cue's little say has all these objections to it. And it says that Moore tells viewers that there are about 50 million people in the U.S. without health insurance. And Linda A. Johnson is quick to say that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated there are about 45 million.
Okay.
So the whole thesis, forget it.
Just forget about the whole thing, right.
But also, I suspect if you said, Michael Moore, in Sicko, you said there's 50 million, and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention said there's only 45 million, he's not going to say, I guess I exaggerated. I'm sure that he would have an argument as to why his figure is accurate. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know what? Personally, I think there's more than that.
Well, that's, I think, what he would get at as well. Moore's taking on the pharmaceutical industry. Moore says it spent the pharmaceutical industry spent millions of dollars lobbying Congress for a Medicare bill that for the drug benefit. He says, of course, and this is from the film, it was really a bill to hand over $800 billion of our tax dollars to the drug and health insurance industry. So here's how they refute it. Last year, however, Medicare officials told the Associated Press that the projected cost of the benefit through 2012 would only be about $729 billion. Said $800 billion, so it turns out it's only $729 billion.
So
that's all they're going to...
Picky.
Yeah. The United States slipped...
The fact is, it's a big old racket.
Yeah. The United States slipped to number 37 in health care around the world, just slightly above Slovenia. Now, he says,
really?
What Moore doesn't say is that Cuba is ranked 39th below Slovenia. Now, what does that say? This third world country is close to the United States in health care provided to its citizens. It's an absolutely poor country.
Yeah.
Yet still is able to provide at least a fairly decent level of health care. Anyway, I would way suggest everyone see it. And the most important thing. Actually, I heard a criticism of Michael Moore. They said that it always turns out to be about Michael. They're always, did Michael fabricate this? Or did he really interview Roger Smith and denied it, the CEO of and Roger and Me, that he was seeking to interview?
Right.
And in Bowling for Columbine, did he do this or that? And so it always becomes about Michael. Well, I don't want to do any psychoanalysis of Michael. I mean, I've known him since probably the 70s, mm-hmm. and, well, let's move on. And he does wonderful work, and I don't care about his personality particularly, or, I mean, he's extraordinarily generous. You know, actually, I don't want to give away the last little bit of the film, but he gives away money to an enemy of his, someone who has denounced him in the most virulent terms imaginable.
Really?
And I'll really give it away if I say why he did it.
Okay, well, don't do that.
No, and why should I even have said that, hey?
No, it's a good teaser, because you're a broadcaster. You know how to tease.
Yeah. And and so whatever flaws there may be, I mean, I was thinking, you know, they go to Cuba. They take these...
Well, yes, there's that whole flap about his trip to Cuba.
And I talked to a friend of mine who knew I'd been to Cuba and Havana, mm-hmm. and she said, wow, it looked like a modern, almost European city.
Right.
Well, Havana is really a little tatty around the edges. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's... So, I don't know, I'm thinking... Did he purposely not show any poverty, or I don't know. But so what? That's not the question. The question is, do we have the wealth in a country like ours to guarantee health care for every citizen in here? Or is it that what we see in this film? I mean, forget it. He's not talking about the 50 million people. I'm sorry. The 45 million people for sure that we know. The government admits. Does not have health care.
But why are we listening to the government?
That's right.
Okay.
And the other 120, 130 million people or families and whatever that have it, and what they're sent through, and we know about people going bankrupt and just the horrible circumstances that could be avoided. But this is a cash cow for investors rather than in all societies that are worthy of the name society. Not just a collection of money grubbers that are within some national boundaries, but takes care of its citizens as a matter of right, as a matter the world owes us health care. Yeah. All right. But here, this little item. I think this may have been on the front page of the New York Times on June 26th. As states in this, sort of a Michael Moore. More proof. As states begin to require that drug companies disclose their payments to doctors for lectures and other services, because these guys make a fortune off that kind of stuff, a pattern has emerged. Psychiatrists earn more money from drug makers than doctors in any other specialty.
Ooh.
That surprised me. I wouldn't have guessed them. I would have thought, like, surgeons, right?
Sure.
Don't you think so? How this money may be influencing psychiatrists and other doctors has become one of the most contentious issues in healthcare. For instance, the more psychiatrists have earned from drug makers, the more they have prescribed a new class of powerful medicines known as atypical antipsychotics to children.
Oh, and we're talking Ritalin here?
No. This is a new group. Ritalin is
a whole new thing?
Yeah.
Ritalin is passé?
These drugs are especially risky and mostly unapproved.
Oh, that is so frightening.
Yeah. Vermont officials disclosed Tuesday that drug company payments to psychiatrists in the state more than doubled last year to an average of $45,000 for each psychiatrist.
Wow.
I mean, how many of you out there... I mean, I forgot what the median... wages for male. I think it's like $28,000 a year, I mean, which isn't much. This is the medium. I mean, half make more, half make less.
And just from this one...
They're getting $45,000. Antipsychotic medicines are among the largest expenses for the state's Medicaid program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Actually, a relative of mine went in to see, I think it was, and she was in high school, and said, what's the matter? And the nurse, she said, I feel depressed. She said, you're clinically depressed. You should be on antidepressants.
I
wonder how much she was getting.
It's pretty quick, the response from some of these doctors to just throw you on the drugs.
Yeah. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, our program is Night Call, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. This is a period in which you have to have a little patience, because... I'm going to rave, Angelina's going to talk.
What does that mean?
I'm just raving. You're discussing. You're talking. That's a compliment.
Okay. I thought, really? You think you're raving?
No.
I've heard you really rave.
No. Well, this isn't. Well, it's all about money.
So you're preparing me for a rave that's coming now?
We'll see.
Okay. Take it away.
So what's it all about? It's all about getting more and more money into the hands of investors in the health industry. So it's not set up in order to keep us well in the first place, to keep us well and to fix us when we get ill, but rather to return investments at the highest rate possible. And the lengths to which these companies go are just amazing. Some of this will come out when you see Sicko. Now, things are getting worse all over the world. Now, I want to try to get at this, connect the dots, as we used to say.
Yes.
This trail of the Leviathan as we go through the inner sanctums of the world wealth, of which the vast majority of the people share in very little, and this the tip of the pyramid gets the vast majority of it. So United Nations is predicting this urban population explosion. I mentioned before this book, Mike Davis, actually it was an essay, you can find it online, called Planet of Slums, just about how the movement, the migration of people, and you're talking New York Times here, this pretty mainstream media source that's actually the friend of big capital. You know, they're not the friend of George Bush, because they realize that these guys, he represents the maniacs of capitalism that are totally out of control and are just solely into looting without the slightest bit of social responsibility. So they're a little better when it comes to them. They also have a lot of information. So what's happening is there's this migration, particularly from, I mean, there's an expanding birth rate in third world countries, but there's also this immense migration from rural areas to the major cities. And it's caused, in good part, by the ruination of these subsistence cultures because of the penetration of global corporations, of globalization of the world economy, which destroys local economies. It's just like the world capitalist economy is like Walmart. So it goes into an area and it does some things that it provides for in a local area, but mostly it destroys the small convivial economies, if you will. So by next year, more than half the world's population, 3.3 billion people, will for the first time live in towns and cities. Well, yeah, they showed a trailer of this Leonardo DiCaprio film about the environment, and part of it was scenes of cities and shanty towns. You know, I'm telling you, this thing was so depressing. Mm. I mean, there was something at the end of Michael Moore's thing that was hopeful, and the people in it, the ill people, are so brave. You warm to them so much. The health care givers in Canada and Britain and Cuba and France are such wonderful people. They are here, too. I don't mean, all my doctors and whatever I've had.
I love my doctor.
Yeah, yeah,
sure.
they're good. But half the people, it's going to be as many by 2030, 5 billion people in cities. So how's that infrastructure going to work? I don't know if I ever mentioned before, but the fact that Hugo Chavez in Venezuela trying to provide housing for the poor of like Caracas, it's impossible. The more the economies get ruined, the more people flood into Caracas.
There's too many people to provide that housing for.
And as their situation goes down the drain, and they say, they're building new housing in Caracas. Let's go there. So this is an absolute horrible situation.
Well, it's creating these slums, is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are. There's cities of slums. In fact, that's Mike Davis's essay and book, Planet of Slums. And so it's the book is, or the study is called The State of World Population 2007, Unleashing the Potential of Urban Growth. So they're thinking, we can do something with this. But the accumulated urban growth of Africa and Asia during the whole span of history will be duplicated in a single generation.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
The other number that just astounded me when I read this article is a sixth of the world's population already now live in slums.
Yeah.
90% of them in developing countries.
And when we see the slums of this country, mm-hmm. Mostly urban, some rural, I mean, we're horrified that people could live like they do in some of the areas of Detroit, and yet this would be heaven.
For these people.
Yeah, for these people in Africa or some South American cities.
Driven through, in some different countries. This is going to sound really bad, but on the way to a resort, say you take the little bus from the airport, and I've seen these shanties, and I've seen it firsthand, and it really affected me. I'm crying in this bus, thinking, oh my God, am I on my way to this vacation, where these people. How they live, and here I go to just go bask in the sun. It kind of made me sick to my stomach.
Well, it did
make me sick to my
stomach. I had the same experience when we flew into Caracas, and the people's houses were, without exaggeration, 4 feet from the road. So we're spewing, like, these diesel fumes into their home, and you could see right into their homes.
Oh,
and they
God.
Had next to nothing. And these people stood at the door, so I was actually, in some cases, closer to the face of the man standing in the doorway than I am to you across this console.
That's amazing.
And I went down there with for the World Social Forum that was had its goal the ending of this equation of great wealth and great poverty, but still it was an embarrassment of riches. Although I don't know if that's the way the phrase is meant. But all right. Which leads us to the immigration bill that just, we're following this from the profit-driven medical system in this country that denies so many people access to it, to this exploding urban population. Now, again, I want to compliment, and some people don't like people that are here illegally to be called illegal immigrants, but they're like undocumented workers. Well, whatever you want to call them, they're illegal immigrants. They're here illegally, all right? These are the admirable people. They are ambitious people that when their economy is ruined, rather than streaming into these already created slums like in Mexico, which is now is not just Mexico City, but the other Mexican metropolitan areas as well, they say, I'm going to go where there is jobs. Half the Mexican population, these are people, there's a line in the sand, and then there's us, of course, our average everything is dropping. But just below this line in the sand, south of us, half the population of Mexico lives on less than $5 a day or less.
God.
Half the entire population. At the same time, the World Millionaires Club is now numbering almost 10 million people. The number of millionaires in the world increased by 8.3% in 2006, with about 9.5 million individuals now estimated to have more than $1 million in financial assets. And what this means, this is the process. So put this all together, people. Just keep, if you will, follow.
Connecting the dots.
Connecting the dots. So you have this increased impoverization of the world's population moving into slums that's going to be, a couple billion in a little while. At the same time, this small group of men at the top of the pyramid is enriching themselves at this absolutely obscene rate. The survey by the financial services group, Capgemini and U.S. investment bank Merrill Lynch, said strong global economic growth and gains on the stock market explain the expansion of the exclusive club of high net worth individuals, HNWISs. That's not what it is. In fact, they really say it. The financial assets owned by the group totaled $37.2 trillion. Now, folks, probably for I don't know what. I haven't really figured this out. Half that, a third that, a quarter that, all this poverty, gone. All this poverty is gone, right? So where is this all coming from? Here's what, the report said. Real GDP, gross domestic product, and market capitalization growth rate. People just blow right by. What the hell is that? Two primary drivers of wealth generation accelerated through 2006, which helped to increase the total number of HN, I don't know what you call it.
It's HNWIs.
Well, Henwies or something, or you'd have to call them around the world, as well as the amount of wealth they control. GDP, gross domestic product, that's the sum total of goods and services produced. All right, you and I, if you're lucky and you're of age and all that, we sell our labor on the market, right? And we're hired by people, and the idea is, since we're a commodity, we're that we will return more through what we produce than what it costs them to pay us. We'll get to General Motors and Delphi in just a minute.
Right.
Okay? So when the real GDP, the gross domestic product, is accelerating and poverty is increasing, and at the same time, there's this incredible expansion of ultra wealth among a sliver of humanity. What's it called? It begins with L. Looting. The rich are getting richer. The poor are getting poorer. The rich are getting richer at the expense of the poor. And every social aspect that comes with it, wars, disease, poverty, misery, you name it, is a result of this. And these 10 million, mostly men, there's some women in there as well, but overwhelmingly men, control enough wealth to ease the pain of the suffering of the world and choose instead to go, did you see that? This guy created this human skull that was like dipped in gold. What are you doing?
Nothing. Don't go there.
Okay. Well, only privileged people can be talking about this and go where I was going.
The gold skull.
Gold skull encrusted with diamonds as an art object. For someone to pay, I forgot what it was, $25 million for.
Oh, God.
And then you look in the doorway in Caracas, or where was it, Jamaica? Is that where you were?
Jamaica, yeah. The Bahamas, you know, a couple different countries.
Like look that. At you.
Cancun. Yeah.
The number of ultra high net worth individuals.
And I'm not one of those,
no,
by the way.
No, no. Individuals with financial assets exceeding $30 million increased by 11.5% or so. 94,970 people. So, I was thinking about, there was a slogan from the 60s that how are you going to drink?
Hippies use the side door?
No. It said, how are you going to drink clean, clear water if you can't get the hog out of the stream?
All right.
Yeah. The collective fortune of these high net worth individuals, now $37.2 trillion, it's expected in the next 4 years to hit $51.6 trillion. And it's going to, unless we sit here, unless the world's population sits here and allows themselves to be looted. Now, you know, actually, I've got too much here. But there's this, we got the richest guy in the world, Bill Gates, right? Maybe not. He may have slipped into second place. There's a man in Mexico, Carlos Slim Elu, and S-L-I-M is his. I thought it was his nickname. And I'm looking at this guy. Why do they call him Slim? I mean, that must be wrong. But it turns out that in so many things, you know, that the family name is in the middle, right?
Oh, sure.
So,
yeah.
So actually, he is Slim, S-L-I-M, Slim. Yeah, mm-hmm. So it's Senor Slim. But he dominates Mexico's telecommunications industry, and he says he handles just about everything. So he's going to start giving away money. He's upping his endowments to his foundations to $10 billion, which is nothing, since I think he's worth... Did you see where it is in here? Oh, his net worth is $53.1 billion. This is one man. Now, those of you concerned with immigration, if this man was to distribute his wealth in an equitable manner, this one man, think about the Mexican people, half of who are making $5 or less a year. And when I say redistribute wealth, I mean in terms of a people working for a living in Mexico that would be granted a living wage, all financed by Senor Slim, down to the point, now this is really commie stuff, right? Because commies always want to take money away from the rich. Leave this dirty capitalist pig with, what do we say, 15 million? Let's leave him with 15 million. That's pretty rough.
He's living fine.
Yeah, yeah. So
he promises to spend the money on education and health. That's what his plan is.
So that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about, folks, is how money is distributed in this country. So we are down here scrambling about immigration and scrambling about health care and scrambling about jobs because of the concentration of wealth and hence their ability to buy political power and make this system of looting continue exactly as it has for, I don't know, the last 4,000 years. So you might say, well, that's the system. Well, they want to make it. We fought back last century. We actually said, hey, we're not letting our kids work in factories. We're going to demand Social Security. We want unemployment compensation. We want, you ready for this one? A decent wage for like working in a factory all our lives or working in an office all our lives or something like that. We want good schools, and that's all going to hell. Not for all. There's going to be about a third of us. You know, I mean, given, I'm white. Middle-class man, I stand a better chance than a lot of folks to make it above the cut. Mm-hmm. But you never can tell.
That's true.
Yeah, I go walk out of here, and there's boss man, say, hey, Pete, been fine, been swell, see you later. And all of a sudden, I'm one of those people without health insurance and what have you. Final thing is, in all of this, of course, is that the Delphi workers have accepted these pay cuts. Not the executives. They're still making their millions. But they're cutting people's wages in half. This is something like from the early 20th century. And, of course, these pay cuts are less than what Delphi originally demanded. But people that were making like $54,000 a year are now going to be making $30,000. And $54,000 for working in a factory, I mean, that makes some sense to me, although I think they're underpaid.
Yeah, and think what's going to happen to these people. I mean, they live a lifestyle based on that $54,000, which means they have probably a mortgage and everything in their lives is based on that. Are we talking more foreclosures in this part of Michigan? Oh, my God.
And, of course, it's all Jennifer Granholm's fault, right? What's going to happen to the economy when instead of having $54,000 to spend, I mean, that's before taxes and everything, that's cut in half. That means there's that much less expendable income.
Right.
So that means that many more small shops and small stores are going to go under. And, of course, the big box stores will move in.
Oh, yeah. And they do well, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They do. Well,
you need to take a commercial break.
We need to take a commercial break, and we need to fight back. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Right back with you.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station, 101. WRIF. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah. back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. Yeah, I was talking quite a bit, and you were helping me out. Maybe we ought to get some callers on.
What? Let's do.
Yeah, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. I'm going to be announcing some events, but you can always go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, and there's an events calendar over on the left if you want to get involved in things. If you don't want to take this peasantization, that's what they got in mind for us, right? They were all going to become their peasants again. We've been fighting them for 200 and 300 years, right? I mean, to some extent, we've been fighting 4,000. That is the elite, the rulers, the ruling class. And once in a while, the common people have some victories. And it looked like we were doing all right for some part, at least in the northern tier countries of the world during the 20th century. But, they're fighting back. We got complacent. We started watching TV. We started sitting in our Barca loungers or whatever. And that's understandable. I mean, those people, they're psychotic, those people that are running things. And they always have been. They're control freaks, greed heads. They're never sleeping. Their little brains are always thinking how they can exploit us. Well, that's what we want to do. We want to hang out, right? I mean, that's what I want to do.
Hang out?
Yeah.
As in?
Is that like some faded phrase?
What are you saying?
I mean, I just want to, listen to music.
Live a good life.
Live a good life. Sit in my backyard, go
that
to
works.
Concerts.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
okay.
I mean, I don't want to have to be surrounded by people, making wars. I was just saying to somebody, hasn't this world had enough of angry men, for instance?
Don't even get me started.
All right, I won't.
Thank you.
We'll talk some more about stuff that's going on. All right. Oh, yeah, we got this new little system. So, yeah, so what do we talk about? Michael Moore's sicko, and then we're also talking about the race to the bottom with Delphi workers accepting pay cuts, and looks like GM workers probably will as well. The whole distribution of wealth in the world, immigration bill, anything you want to hook on to,
Do it.
Yeah, so I have to reach way. I have to come on, turn the phone. This is our setup. Somebody sabotaged our setup. Hi, this is WRIS, Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. You're on the air with this Audrey from Ann Arbor. Hi, Audrey.
Oh, Peter. If I couldn't have talked to you tonight, I might have slit my wrist.
Oh, wow. No. Well, we're glad you got through.
But you know what? I can't do that because they'd probably end up taking me to the hospital, and I'd probably do it. I'd probably die right there.
There you go.
Or you couldn't pay for it.
Yeah, they wouldn't let me in. If I was bleeding, they wouldn't let me in. I have to tell you, this is probably the most high-impact movie as far as telling the truth and the story.
Michael Moore is sicko, you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
As far as telling the truth of the story. And he was very wise to use the stories of individual people. And you cannot argue with what people are actually telling you their life is about. And I don't care what people want to do as far as saying that it's political or it's trickery or whatever. Anybody that walks away from that movie and says that point of view is trickery must really be on high up on the food chain. That's all I can say financially.
Yeah. Sure. I don't know what the refutation of it
is. They are so afraid of what's going to happen because of this movie that they are just out there spitting tacks. I hear it all starting now, the little jabs and the cheap shots and everything, which, some people can go along with that, except if you're in a position like I happen to be, afraid to death that my Medicaid's not going to cover me, and I'm a 60-year-old woman, it is tough on the bottom, and I'm here to testify.
Well, sure. And so let's grant, I don't even know what all the criticisms are, let's grant every single criticism of sicko to the critics. Does that somehow take away from the major thesis of sicko that this private health insurance-based system works to the detriment works to the detriment of great numbers of people, tens of millions of people in this society, and enriches these corporations who have no interest in our well-being at all. Imagine that, a class of healers. I'm not talking about the individual doctors and the nurses. I've got lots of friends that are doctors that are so committed. I have friends who are doctors, a lot of nurses, people connected with the other kinds of healers, people that are, you know, massage therapists and do this thing called Feldenkrais and to some extent even things like Tai Chi, that their interest is in helping. That, and some of them make a living. None of them do I think make a great amount. But you know, one of the things in Sicko, they showed the doctor in France, for instance, doctors are right now, I'm not going to make a lot of money. This guy sounded like he was making a lot of money, that's for sure. All right, I'm glad you got through. Thank you, Audrey, and you're another testimonial for Michael Moore's film. Thanks for joining me. Let's go to Jack. Jack is in Thompsonville. Jack, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on WRIF. Hi.
Hi, Jolene. Hi, Pete. How are you doing?
Doing good.
Yeah, I just wanted to say how the wages, like you have been saying, are going kind of backwards over the years. Like I'm making $7.50 an hour.
Wow.
And back when I started, back about 9-10 years ago, or even longer than that, I was making $5.50 an hour. But I'm a lieutenant now, so in the security firm that I'm working.
And you're making $7.50 an hour.
Yeah.
That's not a living wage.
How are you surviving?
Well, it's not easy. And it's
do you have another wage earner in your house?
Just me.
Wow, so you're making $15,000 a year, essentially.
Yeah, basically, yeah. But, you know, with overtime, I can do a little better.
Yeah. So you're actually what they consider the working poor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just want to let people know that it's, you know, for people out there that have two arms and two legs and a brain, you know, sometimes this is what happens, you know.
And well, I know, and you know what, Jack, is that you are making 50% more than the minimum wage. Minimum wage, is about a little more than $5, so 50%, you know, so that's $7.50. And one of the things we won't face, minimum wage made some sense when it was put into effect like 70 years ago, and it was almost revolutionary when Franklin Delano Roosevelt put it forth as a concept. But now what we have to work for is a guaranteed living wage for everyone. And at $15,000 a year, yeah, even with the overtime, doesn't qualify that at all. It's just outrageous. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Hey, by the way, I mean, I don't even know why I have to say this, but I certainly do not. I wouldn't say, you know what my income is. It's not a handsome. It's okay. It gets me by. I'm sort of lower middle class, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So that works for me. I mean, sometimes people, I mean, they say, well, you're rich, Pete.
Where do they get that?
I don't know. Well, usually most people, particularly people in the working class, often think that people that live in Pleasant Ridge are rich because they're making like $125,000 a year, which does put them, I think, like in 150, that could be like in the 92nd or 93rd mm-hmm. percentile of income.
You know, but you're not saying you make that.
Oh, no. I don't make that.
Okay.
nowhere near that. But the point being is that people in Pleasant Ridge aren't rich. They're upper middle class.
That's true.
Yeah, they're not millionaires. That's true. May be some millionaires in Pleasant Ridge. I don't know. But that's not as professionals and
sure.
you know, people like that. So,
but to a lot of people, that does appear rich.
Yeah. Well, it does by comparison. Yes. But when you start talking about rich, which turns into particularly power, mm-hmm. and that's when you start are part of the command sector of the economy. All right, let's see here. I got to get some more calls. all right, we'll take this one. And this is terrible the way this is set up now. They have numbers on them. Good. Here's Tony in Roseville. Tony, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm calling. Did I think the drug laws are ridiculous, and I support drugs being legalized?
Yeah.
And what I wanted to ask you about is what you mentioned on your show before about the hash bash.
Yeah, it's over for this year.
It's over?
Yeah, it's the first, what is it, first Saturday in April, I think.
Every year?
Every single year, man.
In Ann Arbor.
In Ann Arbor, yeah.
And where exactly is that?
It's on the Diag. There's an area called the Diag, which is...
The Diag.
Yeah, must be... I never thought about that. Must be... Yeah, you walk across it.
I've been wanting to check that out.
Yeah, because you walk across it, like, get this, man.
I think you would really like the hash bash.
Diagonally. Like, totally diagonally.
Dude.
All right. Thank you, Tony. I'll see you there next year.
The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
You seen that movie?
You know, it's like, what? It's on cable again.
Probably.
No, it just came back. Everybody's watched. Dude.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's where I was going with that.
All right. Let's see. We got time. Yeah, we got a lot of time.
Yeah.
313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And here's Kim. Kim's in Rochester. Go ahead, Kim. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to thank you for kind of dumbing down some of the terminology that we hear all the time in the news.
Like?
And I think, gross domestic
product. Oh, yeah.
I think a lot of people out there don't really understand what that means, so thank you for taking the time to do that.
Good explanation, Peter.
Well, yes, very good.
Thank you. Thank you both. A
couple of quick questions, though. You had very briefly mentioned that it was Jennifer Granholm's fault.
And he was joking.
I was joking. Okay. I was being facetious.
I wondered if someone would take that the wrong way.
Yeah, because what I meant, Kim, was that here is the auto companies are making this frontal assault on the standard of living and the wages of tens of thousands of workers who are going to have less money to spend, and more businesses are going to go out of business, and real estate is going to sell for less, and people are going to say, it's Jennifer Granholm's fault.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't. I didn't mean that for me. You're right. You got to be careful what you say on radio. People,
because you know what, Peter, you said it, and you and I gave each other that look like, yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's her fault, but no one can see us.
Aren't the webcams on?
Please don't. No webcams.
Yeah. You know, guys, I also just quickly wanted to point out, I'm actually just driving back from a trip to our nation's capital, and it was really great, and, you know, very moving, of course, to always see Arlington.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
My national cemetery. But one of the things as you were talking that I was thinking about is that we always talk about our soldiers fighting for our freedoms, but they're also fighting for the American way of life, which used to be a roof over everyone's head, a chicken in every pot, a car in every garage, and it's getting to exactly what you're talking about now, that not only have we changed to a society where there's a rich and a poor, but we're also utilizing our soldiers and this term of freedom to mean freedom for those with money.
Well, sure. It's essentially with, right from the beginning, a war for oil, a war for empire. And these people like Bush and Cheney, who are these rich, privileged people who scammed out of the war in Vietnam at the same time they supported it. They consider, that when they go through all this stuff about support our troops, but they see the troops as cannon fodder for their grand ideas of securing oil, getting bases, and stuff like that. And they're just horrible people. And they can't be allowed to stay in office for the next year and a half. I mean, they have been.
Peter, they are going to be.
Yeah.
You know it.
I suppose they are. I mean, just the New York Times editorial today says, after 6 years of kowtowing to the White House, Congress is finally challenging President Bush's campaign to trample all legal and constitutional restraints on his power. This is a prestigious paper, probably the single most prestigious paper in the country. Real, centrist paper. And they say that the man sitting in the White House has been on a campaign to trample all, not some, not a few, but all legal and constitutional restraints on his power. I mean, I don't know what kind of indictment you could get stronger than that, eh?
Yeah, and last week it was Cheney who said he's not part of the executive.
Yeah, why doesn't he find another something to be part of? All right, thank you.
Remember, he has his own planet.
Yeah.
His planet of insanity, I think he should call it.
Thank you, Kim. Here's a couple of emails. I actually should have gotten your okay on this because I don't want to put you on the spot. You know
what
I mean?
No.
No. You know how sometimes we've gone on Monday afternoons to that peace vigil at
yes.
the in Ferndale at the
mm-hmm.
corner of 9 Mile Road in Woodward, and
yeah.
people honk if you're for peace. Oh, you can't do that
Wait.
Anymore.
Yeah, don't be encouraging yeah. that, Peter.
But they're at it. So here's what I was thinking about doing, and that I was going to go to that. It's 4:45 to 5:45, and then there's an action with a group called Jobs with Justice, and
sure.
they're going to Royal Oak Ford, where the management, according to them, has stalled negotiations and fired union sympathizers. It's been more than a year since workers voted for UAW representation. Still no contract. So people are going to be up there from 5:30 to 7:30. That's just north of 11 Mile Road in Royal Oak for informational picketing and flyer distribution. So I'm going to go to... It's on my website, again, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. You can go to the calendar section. And this, boy, this made me feel good. Pam from Wyandotte wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hi, Peter. I remember hearing you say that you protest the occupation of Iraq every week at the same time for 1 hour. I don't do it. I don't.
Right.
I haven't been there in quite a few weeks, but there are.
There
some,
is a protest yeah. every week for 1 hour.
And you even invited me to attend once in an email. I never made it out your way, and since nobody had anything going in these parts, Wyandotte, I decided to put it together myself. We've been protesting now for about 7 weeks, and the group grows every week. Seeing
Wonderful.
Us out there, yeah, seeing us out there has given people the opportunity to express their own outrage and to get involved. Thank you for the idea and the inspiration. I put together a little blog, mostly to post some of the protest photos. And here's the link. And I'll tell you, Pam, it was hard to see when these were. I kind of went through the blog site, and I couldn't find out. So you might want to put very prominently where your actions are. But you can go to wyandotteprotest.blogspot.com. Wyandotteprotest.blogspot.com.
Perfect example right here, Peter, of the ripple effect.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're going to get in trouble if we don't do these commercials before midnight.
No trouble.
Here, when we come back, speaking of Wyandotte, Bill is in Wyandotte as well. And he's written a letter to our morning crew, Drew
okay.
and Mike,
yeah.
about me and them. We'll be back and we'll
okay.
tell you about that. Take your calls at 313-298-WRIF right after these.
We're looking out there.
The pictures. The podcast. The blog.
The special features you just can't get.
Anywhere else. Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall do just that.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Thank you.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Jalene Jordan, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Peter.
313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, if you want to get on the air. And at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, I'll be interviewing our old friend, Norman Solomon, from the Institute for Public Accuracy. He has a brand new DVD out called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Actually, we're going to talk with Guy Dauncey. I love that name. He is, we're talking to him in British Columbia, but I think he's English. But he, you know, in fact, I start the interview with saying, if I heard on a radio show someone's going to talk about cancer, I'm going to click, I'm out of here.
You right, know. How depressing.
Yeah.
But can I tell something about Norman Solomon?
Sure.
You know, this is a kind of a cool little pop culture slash Iraq tidbit. He's the one who took Sean Penn over to Iraq.
That's right. And Sean Penn is the narrator of Norman Solomon's new DVD, War Made Easy.
There you go.
Yeah. Guy Dauncey, though, the subtitle is 101 Solutions to a Preventable Epidemic.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I choose which one goes first. Don't tell Norman, but we're going to do Guy Dauncey's first.
Okay.
Yeah.
I won't tell.
All right. $3.15 a gallon at the pump, although I saw it for $3.09 coming in Iran. Here's how they deal with it. Unrest spread in Tehran on Thursday, the second day of gasoline rationing in oil-rich Iran.
Or rationing.
Yeah, that's what I was. I always say rationing in oil-rich Iran.
Sorry.
With drivers lining up for miles, gas stations being set on fire, and state-run banks and business centers coming under attack. Now, I'm not suggesting that as a solution. But
no, but the whole Iran thing and this whole importing of yeah. Gas and oil is just a very confusing thing to me.
No, well, that's what they're claiming here. They don't have enough refineries. They don't have enough refinery capacity, so they have to import gasoline.
Archaic refining.
Yeah. You can't burn oil, right?
From what I understand.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. You can't burn oil. Right. You got to refine it into gasoline, and that's here in the U.S. in order to keep the price up. They purposely have limited refinery capacity. In Iran, I think the gas, what did I see? 34 cents a gallon. Even though they're, you know, they cost them $2 a gallon, so they're distributing it, they're selling it at considerably below the price that the government of Iran pays for it.
Hmm.
On the other hand, in Venezuela, remember I've said this before, where literally gasoline is cheaper than water; it's 14 cents a gallon.
And a portion of the proceeds, as they say, go to those in poverty.
Yeah, except there's not not much there.
Right.
Okay, Drew and Mike is our wonderful morning show, our pals, and one of the most successful morning shows in the entire country.
Oh, heck yeah.
They had, I wish I could, if I remembered off the top of my head, their percentage of the listening population in the mornings, 5:30, God, they carry on till sometimes.
Sometimes 11:45, yeah. I've heard them on.
They're out of control.
They go forever.
Yeah. But they're amazing. But like so many other, I never had this happen. Like so many other morning shows, they're mixed, but they're kind of right wing on a lot of stuff, right? I can talk about them because
you know
asleep,
what?
I
was
through, Mike.
Yeah, probably by now. I left the station for 3 years and came back, and I was really surprised by how, especially Drew
yeah.
has changed and is against the war and
against Bush. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Before I left, not so much.
Well, here is what Bill and Wyandotte wrote to Drew and Mike, and a copy to me. Love the show and have been listening for over 10 years. That's my show. That being said, I find it humorous that you guys, talking to Drew and Mike, especially Drew, have completely reversed your position on the war, so much so that you are now agreeing with Peter Werby and his position that you so violently opposed 4 years ago.
Have they said that on the air, that they agree with Peter Werby?
I have no idea. I get up. Well, I guess I hear them sometimes,
yeah.
When they go to 11. Since Peter's view hasn't wavered, it would seem a concession apology on your part, Drew, is now due to him.
Oh, no. They don't need to apologize.
Yes, they do.
No, they don't.
Yes,
they do?
Grovel.
You know, think about all of
grovel.
Those people way back then when you and I were broadcasting and we said it was wrong from the start.
Yeah.
Do all those people need to apologize?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, they, you know what? Here, no, they don't need to apologize. Neither Drew and Mike.
We're glad that they've come around this way. It's just unfortunate that they didn't get it from the damn beginning.
Well, what they should do is learn a lesson. You know, twice, what is it? Once burned, twice.
Wait a minute.
What's the song?
Bush is the one who messed this one up.
Yeah, so not a, no.
So don't do it.
No. what's the song by, not the...
Once Bitten, Twice Shy?
Yeah, what's the guy? The Mata Hoople guy or something? No, not the Mata. What is it? I'm losing my rock and roll chops. He was just here in Detroit, too.
You mean Alice Cooper?
No. No, an Englishman.
Oh, anyway. Okay.
Yeah. Once bitten, twice shot. That's what you should be the next time they start telling you, oh, we have to bomb around because, or
right.
Whatever. Yeah, remember.
Think about it.
If they're on television, they're wearing a suit or a uniform.
And they're yapping.
Yeah, at least have some skepticism. What I do is I assume they're lying until I can find out differently, as opposed to the opposite. This way, we wind up in a war because you assume they're telling the truth. And because, gee, would they lie to us? The president? Anyway, Bill from Wyandotte finishes up, along with Drew and Mike, Peter Werby Night Call. It's the other reason why WRIF is Detroit's best radio station.
Rock on, brother.
Rock on. All right. So, where's my magic, whatever this is here?
It's a mouse.
That's a mouse.
You knew that. You know more about computers than I do.
Well, that's easy.
Gee, thanks.
All right, let's... this must be, yeah. All right. I'm the reason I'm kind of bumbling around here, our little setup here.
Our phone system.
It's totally screwed as usual. All right. Our number 313.
To put it lightly.
Yeah, WRIF. Here's Tim in Lincoln Park. Tim, it's Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. You're on WRIF. Hi.
How are you guys doing tonight?
Good.
Great.
Well, this kind of pains me to say it, but I've become disillusioned with my friend Hugo Chavez down in Venezuela.
Yeah, well, good.
I've been finding a few things out. I found out that his company, Citgo, has been putting benzene in the rivers and streams in Texas. Now, to be fair, I mean, I have no idea if he personally knows that or not, but, I mean, it's you know, a pretty serious indictment. Also, he's been, I guess, packing the quartz down there in Venezuela with a lot of his supporters.
Well, listen. I've been, I never got to the point where I was putting forth my criticisms of Chavez, and he's centralizing power. It's still, he's a democratically elected president. You can still publish a newspaper that says Chavez stinks, and, I don't know where he has to go. For one thing, his dependence on fossil fuel sales, on oil sales, and, dealing in the international market, creating industrial expansion, particularly in environmentally sensitive areas and in indigenous areas. I might have mentioned this before. When I was in Caracas, I went to this demonstration of indigenous people that were trying to stop coal exploration in one of the states there. They're saying, wait a minute, man, you're going to start digging up our sacred land? And he's saying, because he's caught up. He's caught up in the international economy, which doesn't allow for any soft spot in your heart for indigenous people or their sacred grounds or what have you. You know, it's a sacred grove to people that know how to live in the earth, and to capitalists, it's timber, right?
Now, with a lot of the money that he's bringing in with oil, could he go more toward, a solar economy, given the fact that Venezuela is, fairly close to the equator and so on?
Well, you would think so, but I've never heard anything. Well, I don't know. You know, there's some innovative people there. He doesn't seem intent on being this brutal dictator. I mean, that there's been more police repression. I mean, when I saw this demonstration, it was protected by the police and no one looked, everyone was at ease. And, if you've been to demonstrations, when that tension in the air from the cops frequently.
Oh,
and
yeah, they're demonstrate. Quite scary, yeah.
Well, it wasn't, none of that was there, but there's been a number of demonstrations a little more repressed, not as much as here. In other words, the United States is much more of a police state, easily, than Venezuela. And if anybody doubts that, call me up and challenge me on it. Venezuela, well, I don't know what poor countries, even ones that are oil rich, can really do, because when the world economy is still dominated by the Western powers. But,
so there's not enough money, in other words, for them to say, okay, we have the oil economy, but then we can kind of diversify as well.
Well, you would think so. I don't think that there's enough oil economy to deal with the poor of that country or of that region. I mean, he's trying to stop American corporate hegemony, domination of that sector of the world. And to that extent, that the corporations here aren't enriching themselves at the expense of people in South America and Latin America in general, as the United States has done for 150 years or so, is a good thing. The fact that he, you know, it's fun to listen to Chavez call Bush El Diablo and, you know, the devil and all that. And he says, I smell sulfur in this room.
You know, there's $37.2 trillion in the world owned by, what is it, 9,470 people or something?
Right, we were just going through that a little earlier.
Can't we find a way to just take all that and redistribute it evenly or something?
Oh, yeah.
They're not giving it up.
Well, no, listen, you sound like a commie, Tim. I'm still on the capitalist model. I just say take about 95% and leave these guys with tens of millions. And they can still buy all their, you know, their rich trinkets and their yachts. And they can still, hey, listen, I mean, we got to be realistic. And world of equality isn't feasible. So what we can do is just change the equation of super looting down into the minimal of looting, and that way these guys could still buy their governments and buy all their trinkets and what have you. And but still, but it's pathological. It's a system of pathology. I mean, what kind of system would allow this type of concentration of intense wealth, trillions of dollars, where other people, like just our neighbors, that are really our neighbors in Mexico, half the country to live on $5 a day. That's pathology or sociopathic behavior. People without a slightest conscience. Those are the only kind of people that could do that. All right, Tim, thank you very much. And in fact, let me just step a little away from the mic here and come back here. And these are views, by the way. Sometimes people say, you know, Peter, you're so radical. Well, somebody said once, the task is to be more radical than reality, which is difficult often. There's an article, which, Jolene, you may have seen in this week's Nation magazine. You can go to thenation.com or .org. Probably it's got .com. Yeah, thenation.com. Will the progressive majority emerge? But forgetting about what they're talking about, they're talking about us. There's a massive 20-year roundup of public opinion from the Pew Research Center for People in the Press. It's called Trends in Political Values and Core Attitudes in the Last 20 Years. And, you know, they're always talking about this conservative revolution and how everybody's become conservative and all that. Get these figures. In 1994, the year the conservative Republicans captured Congress, 57% of us thought that the government should care for those who can't take care of themselves. That was back then. Now it's 69%. Even 58% of the Republicans agree.
Wow.
Republicans have conscience? I didn't, well, maybe here I'm learning something. The proportion of Americans who believe government should guarantee every citizen enough to eat and a place to sleep is 69%. Even 69% of self-identified Republicans and 75% of small business owners favor raising the minimum wage by more than $2. So you've been told, if you have what's called liberal opinions, tolerant opinions, caring opinions, that you're some kind of freak, right? You're in the majority. We're in the majority. We always have been. Americans are decent people. We have these creeps. These psychotics, and they're not psychotic. Some of them are, actually, like Cheney is certifiable, I think, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Vice President Snarly, right?
Is that his name of the week?
Yeah. And the Pew study was not just asking about do-good, something-for-nothing abstractions. It asked about trade-offs. The majority, 54%, think, quote, government should help the needy, even if it means greater debt. Which we don't have to have any debt. We need to tax the ultra wealthy, reduce the defense, the war budget, really, by half at minimum to start. Two-thirds want the government to guarantee health insurance for all citizens. So two-thirds of us, 66% or whatever, what is it, 66 point something, think we ought to have a national health program. Why don't we have it? How come? Let's see, more. Even among those who otherwise say they'd prefer a smaller government, 57% say that they believe that that should be the case. 57% also believe labor unions are necessary to protect the working person. And this also is echoed by the National Election Studies survey. More than twice as many Americans want, quote, government to provide many more services, even if it means an increase in spending, and want fewer services in order to reduce spending. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I said that wrong. The majority want an increase in spending. According to Gallup, a majority say they generally side with labor in disputes, only 34% with companies. 53% think unions help the economy, only a third think they hurt. This is astounding figures if you think how views like this have been characterized over the last 25 years. We are not an embattled, isolated majority. We are mis- and ill- and non-reported. That is the deal. Let's see if there's anything more in here. 53% of Americans thought the Bush tax cuts were not worth it because they have increased the deficit and caused cuts in government programs. The other 47% think it's good. Only 25% want to see Roe versus Wade, the abortion case, overturned, and on and on and on. Oh, yeah. Found the public rejecting government-funded... Oh, yeah. The Kaiser Family Foundation, Harvard, found the public rejecting government-funded abstinence-only education in favor of, quote, more comprehensive sex education programs that obtain information on how, that include information on how to obtain and use condoms and other contraceptives by 67% to 30%. We are the majority. We are the majority.
You're saying things aren't as insane as it appears.
We're not as insane as the people that have the suits on television and the MSN.
And running the government.
And the mainstream media.
Oh, right, right.
That is really clear. All right, some of these people have been waiting a long time. Let's see if we can... Well, this doesn't work, does it? I got to reach way over here. You're listening to Night Call. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Tim in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Tim.
Oh, it's Jim. Is that Peter there?
Yeah, this is Jim. Okay, I got a T up here on your name, but go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, Peter, big-time fan, long-time listener. When I was a younger man, I was a merchant seaman, and I worked for the big oil companies on some of their ships. Now I work for the healthcare industry. I can't say who I work for because I could get fired.
Okay.
But you can work for them for like 30 years, and if you live long enough to retire, you only have health benefits for 30 days.
Oh, my God.
And most people don't believe that. Now, my big question, Peter, is I keep hearing wherever I read or on TV that America's the richest country in the world. And I think our debt is $8 trillion, and I believe we're borrowing money from Red China and Japan for the war in Iraq.
Well, just to keep the country financed, yeah.
Well, it always seems like an oxymoron to me when I hear the United States is the richest country in the world, and we're living like this. Can you help me understand?
You know any compulsive gamblers?
No.
Okay. Well, you know what a compulsive gambler is.
Sir.
That he can't help himself, or she can't help himself spending way beyond their means.
Correct.
Yeah. So it's, I don't know. I mean, it's not quite, I'm sure these people.
It's a pretty good analogy.
Well, these people must have some scheme, or maybe they don't. Maybe they are just plain crazy.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, it's.
It could be as simple as that.
Yeah.
All right, Jim. Thank you for joining us. Oh, all right, as I go down the list here, here is Nader in Walled Lake. Nader, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Well, listen, you know, I want to basically tell you that I'm actually an insurance broker, and I have been for a number of years, and I used to work in the radio business years ago, so I've been on both sides of the fence of being a W-2 employee and now 1099.
Gotcha.
But what I want to get at with you is that basically when it comes to health insurance, here in the U.S., it really, even though it functions as a capitalist economy, everybody wants it to function really as a socialist economy where they want this universal health care.
Okay? Yeah.
And I did want to point out to you that basically that insurance companies, the private insurance companies other than Blue Cross, and I rep everything from Blue Cross to Delta Dental and everything in between, that private insurance companies are in the business to make money, not lose money.
Right, right.
Okay. So when it comes down to this universal health care, that's not really going to happen because what are we going to become a second or third world country at that point? I mean,
Wait. Do you think England and Italy and France and Norway and Denmark and Canada are third world countries?
We're the only industrialized country in the world without this type of health care.
Right, but I mean, wasn't this founded on the principles of capitalism?
Well, last time I checked, every one of those countries I mentioned was a capitalist country.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. So in other words, you want the government to subsidize people for their health insurance. That's what the majority of these people calling in are saying. And
well, sure. And that's what a universal single-payer health plan is about, is the government provides health service in the same manner that they provide a post office or police or fire, something so fundamental to us that it can't be left to what you're unfortunately representing. I mean, I don't think anybody's trying to, I mean, there'd have to be some way, is it people like you, or I'm sure is a decent person with decent feelings about other people, that, you know, that you wouldn't just be fired. But we have to have, you know, and when you, I mean, I've read enough, and now when you see, like, Michael Moore's movie Sicko, that the idea is essentially, how can you not have payouts? Because the more you pay out, the less you, you know, the less profits you make. You want to keep the sick people away so that they're not covered. If they claim, you know, benefits, how can we deny them benefits? And that's what's, so the motivation is not to heal people or not to keep people well and not, well, it's actually a little to keep people well. That happens. But it certainly is not to heal people. As you said, it's to make money. And this is too crucial to us as human beings, to our families and to ourselves, to, you know, to leave it to people's schemes to how they can make more money. And what I said, we get sick, they get rich.
I agree with you. I totally agree with you because here's the bottom line. I know you love statistics, okay?
Sure.
And you're going to love this one because it comes from all these statisticians and actuaries of all the insurance companies that I work with. That literally, people are only admitted overnight to a hospital 1.8 times their entire life.
Okay.
Okay, so if you look at that statistically, odds are very, very low that you actually be hospitalized. And if you are more than 1.8 times, then that means probably either due to an accident or family history.
Well,
if you look at it that way, yeah, and then you look at 98% of all claims are less than $5,000.
Yeah.
Okay, why do we need this universal health plan? Because all it's going to do is provide more taxation on people, especially here in Michigan. And you know the economy here is very poor.
Well, all right, that's an item. And I said right now that the wealthy get taxed very, very lightly compared to their overall wealth. So you need an extraordinarily progressive tax on the upper, not on Joe and Jane making $25,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 a year, but the people that are making like the really big bucks that are, because when you have a society, when you have such a variance in the way people live, and when you have a health system of the wealthiest country in the world that's rated the 37th, that's just above Slovenia, I mean, come on, that does not live up to the potential. When you have, you know, some 1.5 million or 2 million homeless people, when you have tens of millions of people living in what the government considers poverty, and it's probably twice that if you use the figure that you and I would demand for a standard of living, something is really, really wrong here. All right, thank you, my friend. Thank you for calling in, 313-298-WRIF. And did you want to say something? I heard a little,
No.
I thought I heard one of those.
I'm intently listening.
Mouth noises.
probably did.
This is hard. I got a 1, 2, 3. This is not the way this is supposed to be set up, people. But let me see. Hopefully.
You can do it, Peter. Yes, just go for it.
Hopefully I have Chris in Ann Arbor.
You're a veteran.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Pete, Tulane. How's it going?
Hi.
Going well.
Great.
Good. I just want to do some nitpicking about Sicko, like you were mentioning, kind of like the last caller. Well, first off, you got to admit, Pete, I don't know about Jelaine, she hasn't seen it, but you have to admit it was a pure propaganda piece, right?
See, I knew that word was coming. I knew it.
Well, you know, I'm not even sure what that means. If you talk about in propaganda, suggests dishonest, self-serving information that usually
kind
on the part
lies,
of the government.
Really.
Yeah, like the Soviet Union had propaganda,
brainwashing.
Totalitarian states have propaganda. On the other hand, what it really means is you're propagating an idea. And a friend of mine who's visiting from Quebec, staying with us, she said that the phrase pamphlets in French really means a short, one-sided argument for a position. And that's what the film was.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, all propaganda has plenty of truth in it. And,
well,
you know,
no,
we
it
talk
doesn't.
About, well, yeah, sure it does. I mean, it lists some truth. I mean, what propaganda was just pure lies? You know, they're. Well, gotta have some kind of truth, or nobody would buy it, you know?
Well, most people that, for instance, one of the ways that people dealt, well, they found out the news in Izvestia or Pravda in the Soviet Union, if they said we've had record high grain production, they'd know it was a failed harvest. You know, all you have to do is just, you know, do the 180 degree opposite.
Right, right.
So give me the critique of Moore's film, though.
Well, like you said, it was the one-sided argument, like a pamphlet in France. I mean, you got the worst of the worst in the U.S. here, and it was a good film, and I agree that the U.S. system sucks here. But then you got the best of the best in Canada, Britain, France. I mean, everything was just great, you know? Not one person that complained. Even Cuba. I mean, obviously, you can admit Cuba has some grim healthcare situations going on there.
Well,
none of it was shown. None of it was discussed, referenced.
Well, let me, I don't think I'm giving away anything, it seemed like France particularly was heaven, and we had all these Americans who were living there sitting around talking about how wonderful it was and it did, they have incredible social benefits, but they also showed all these demonstrations that workers complaining about they're trying to lengthen the workday, they're taking away benefits, they're trying to cut wages, so the same kind of austerity program, austerity thrust by the by management is happening there as well, and I don't know why for a poor person, probably the best place in the Western Hemisphere, well, let's say in Latin America, the best place in Latin America for a poor person would be in Cuba. And when you start looking at the infant mortality rates, for instance, in Cuba or in downtown Detroit. I mean, you want your baby born in Cuba, without a doubt. I mean, they have so much incredible programs. They have family-friendly medicine and social programs. Does that mean that it's acceptable to run a one-man rule? Does it mean that it's okay to do that? No. Does it mean that it's okay to have a continuation of the same leadership year after year without those kind of democratic elections? No, it doesn't mean that at all. But in terms of how a poor country is run under current world conditions, it doesn't get much better than Cuba.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, we'll go back to France, like you mentioned, with the demonstrations, how we showed how they're trying to lengthen the work week and cut benefits. And, you know, he didn't mention the deficit in France, how it's and how they just elected a conservative leader.
Well,
you know, because they're going bankrupt. They can't pay for what they have.
Well, yeah, for one thing, that was made before Sarkozy won. But also, this is what's happening all over the Western world because of globalization. All of the benefits that are that workers, particularly in the Scandinavian countries and Germany and France, what they've achieved over the last 100 years is absolutely amazing. And, I mean, people just wouldn't even believe it. 6 and 8 weeks guaranteed vacations and maternity and paternity leave and everything one needs should have for a comfortable life. But because capital has been globalized like it never has before, you're competing with people making 15 cents an hour, and they're going to say, hey, if you're going to try to live a middle-class life in Italy or Germany, we're going to go make our products where people live and work in the worst possible conditions, and you're just not going to have a job. So here's your and that's it. That's capitalist blackmail. Either you start taking wage cuts, or you're not going to have a job. Either you start reducing your benefits, or we're going to go to China or Mexico or something like that. And that's always the devil's choice that we're presented. Ain't very pretty. All right, thank you very much, Chris. We got some open lines. And what happened to all you people? We had full phones, and then they all dropped off.
I don't know. Maybe they were impatient. Call back.
Come on.
313-298-WRIF. You know, I got caught up in one of those protests in Paris.
Really?
Yeah, and I was in a taxi. And I was on the way to go see Jim Morrison's grave.
Okay.
And this French cab driver said, I'm so sorry, the protests all over the city today. I mean, it was a hefty taxi price to get over there.
You know, here we're telling people we're just these ordinary folks that don't make much money. And
this was back when times were better.
So I'm off to Cuba and Venezuela and Europe. You're off to Europe.
I'm
and
not going to Europe anytime soon. Let's put it that way. That was then. This is now.
All right. So we've got open lines. We're going to go into our final segment. So anything that we've talked about over the last little bit, give us a call. As Julian said, 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan will be back with you after these.
This is WRIM.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. Jalene Jordan is with me, as are you. And Sigrid writes in, Dear Peter and Jalene, the space warrior turned peace activist will be here at the invitation of Peace Action of Michigan, along with seven co-sponsors this coming Sunday evening, July 8th at 7 p.m. at the Pleasant Ridge, speaking of, Community Center. And Dr. Bowman is a Ph.D. in aeronautics and nuclear engineering. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, flew 101 combat missions. So what's he talking about here? His extremely timely talk will be about missile defense, catalyst for a new and dangerous arms race, and other serious threats. She says, go hear him. You will not be disappointed. Real difficult, I'm sure, to have gotten all that. And probably almost impossible for me to tell you the directions to the
Peace play. Action. Do they have a website?
Yeah, I think they do. But you could also go to my website. What the hell? Send them to mine.
PeterWerbe.com. W-E-R-B-E.
You're cold, aren't you?
What do you mean?
Well, you got your hoodie all
freezing.
Well, what's with me? My face is flushed.
I don't know.
Who cares about us?
You're
right?
Fired up, baby.
Yeah, I'm fired up. All right, where are we going with this? Marianne's been waiting patiently. Hi, you're on the air with Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Go ahead. Yep, I forgot. I did the old-fashioned way. Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, Peter.
Wait. Hold on here. I see what I did wrong. Marianne, hi. We got you now.
Okay. Good morning, Peter and Jolene.
Hi.
Good morning. That sounds a little more correct.
Yeah.
Yes. How about those Northwest pilots? They were furloughed. They were laying them off. And they were overworking them, overtaxing them, and they did a little bit of flight flu.
Right.
And now they're calling them back.
Well,
Northwest
good.
Has to call them back.
Yeah.
I've seen all those cancellations. And,
the old industrial workers of the world used to say, direct action will get you satisfaction.
Amen.
I love it.
Yeah. They better fix it because I'm supposed to fly to Boston in a few weeks.
Well, especially for you, Peter. You better get that fixed.
Yeah.
You elitist.
Settle this labor dispute, please.
Listen to this elitist.
Yeah.
I wonder how many of these people who are calling in and complaining about having universal health care have good insurance.
Most likely.
But you know, Marianne, nobody's called in and complained about it, have they?
No, I mean, you know, the guys who are not... excuse me, I got that
the last
wrong.
Couple of calls.
The people who are complaining about having it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, I think that actually one of the people that I went with sort of objected to the film. He was saying, you know, he shows it so black and white, everything's perfect in Canada and France when in terms of...
Well, it's not.
No.
Nothing's perfect.
And, and
well,
so...
maybe Denmark.
So you'd have to do a whole film on the Canadian health system.
Right.
Yeah, in order to, quote, show both sides of it. And what
I've said, Michael Moore only has so much time, okay?
And remember, what I've said all along is that the problems with the Canadian health system are that it's not funded enough. So Canadians can have two choices. You can have an army, which is absolutely unnecessary for Canada to have. There's another country in the Western Hemisphere that doesn't have an army, Costa Rica. And they realize the only country that's going to invade them is the United States, and the same with Canada. And you can't stand up to the United States armed forces. So why do you have an army? And then people say, well, we're peacekeepers. Well, come on, you're just involved in this war in Afghanistan where more and more civilians are being killed, where the Taliban is actually spreading its influence. This war against the Taliban, rather than being another Bush F-up, if you will, has now expanded the power of Taliban and Taliban-esque forces in Pakistan to the point where they're controlling whole regions. And remember what weapon Pakistan has in this nasty little military dictatorship?
What, oil or heroin?
Nuclear bombs.
Oh, okay. Wrong one.
Right. So we could have a Taliban with a nuclear weapon. Wouldn't that be swell?
All these things we've done.
Well, watch your pronoun.
What?
We.
Well, oh, that's right.
They.
They. Them. Thank you. Thank you for correcting me there.
Yes. All right, Marianne. Thank you. Appreciate your call.
Yes.
And here is Eno in Roseville. Eno, hi. You're on the air. Yep, wait a minute. I got to do a little something here. Go on. I'm learning this system. Go ahead.
Mr. Werbe.
Hey, Dad, there's a call for you.
Hey, I'm a longtime listener. I'm talking about Canadian.
Yeah.
I heard that they have unlimited health care, and I'm sick, and I go down to the medical, and I can't afford it because I lost my job. This state is going downhill. I don't know why, but... I got a doctor bill that I can't afford, and I have to
get
pay
in,
rent.
Get in line. There are so many people who are in your situation, and I'm glad that you're sharing your personal situation because people need to hear that.
I was in a doctor's office. A woman came in a wheelchair, And they said, I'm sorry, without health insurance, the doctor can't see you. And the woman started crying.
Tell the story again. You're going to make me cry.
Yeah. No, that's the kind of, the system that we have now.
And Michael Moore only chose the few who, you know, this is what the writer, whatever,
yeah,
the industry is going to say. He's only chosen a few. Well, there's a few, what did we say, 45 million?
Yeah. That turns out to be, well, and it's not just the 45 million or 50 million, as Michael Moore says.
Or more, as I say.
That it's also the tens of millions of people that have health insurance that cost them a pretty penny. Like my insurance, I have thousands of dollars of copay. I probably, between what's taken out of my pay the company here is very generous. I'm not stroking them, but I got to pay at least $2,000 a year, and then now the copays are up to $25. And
I know when you told me that, I couldn't believe that. I'm shopping for individual health insurance right now, Peter, and I want to tell you something. It is scary.
How much?
It's
frightening. Like $600 a month?
No, it's not that much, but it's the bottom of the totem pole insurance in case I get sick, basically.
You're not going to need that much coverage.
For the first year, no doctor's visits are covered.
Oh!
On and on. It's a nightmare. I don't really talk about my personal situation, but I am a part-time employee, so that's the way it goes.
Yeah. And all of this, by the way, one of the that now General Motors, the big three, say they've got to kick down the benefits and the wages for the UAW workers because the Japanese companies they pay so much less. I'm not sure what the hell that has to do with. So GM stockholders, make less money, pay your workers a decent wage. But that if the government picked this up, right? If the government picked up the cost, if this was a shared social cost, seen as a necessary social service for all of us, well, then maybe even these guys who can't seem to operate car companies worth a damn, right? Because why are they in the trouble? Well, those UAW janitors. Remember that guy? Were you on the show when that guy? No, I don't think you were. He said, well, you know what's wrong with the auto companies? Those UAW janitors that are getting $26 an hour and aren't doing anything.
Oh, I was on the show.
Remember, and I said to him, how many UAW janitors are there? And he said the famous sound, huh? And I said, how many UAW janitors are there? All right. Okay, let's get some more calls on the air.
Full
here.
Lines.
Yep, here is Paul in Commerce. Paul, it's Peter and Jalene on WRIF.
Peter, Jalene, how are you doing?
Doing great.
I just retired. I'm 53, got my 30 years on. I'm one of the old dinosaurs. I have the Blue Cross, creme de la creme, the best of the world.
From the auto companies?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, great.
Ford, lucky you.
They just closed it down. But I'm going to give you my perspective in health insurance. I go over to, Huron Valley Sinai. I cut my finger one day with a chainsaw. I stand in line behind 23 people. You know why? Because they don't have insurance. They're scared. They're going to be scared. They're going to be sued out of their business.
Oh.
This is what happens. And for Michael Moore, and I like Michael Moore. I do. I think he's a great guy. I like all his films. I'm a union guy. I'm a liberal, all that. But the fact is, you can walk into any hospital and get better health care in this country than if you have health insurance because they're scared.
Good job.
They're going to sue you out of your pants. I know my doctor personally when I see him on a weekly visit, not a weekly visit, I see him every couple months, I wait an hour or two, but he has someone in his office. So I said, why is it taking me an hour and a half when I had a 2 o'clock appointment? Now it's 3:30. He says, because that person doesn't have insurance. And he says, the odds are 10 times more. He's going to sue me out of my practice before you do because you have insurance.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you, they just don't accept him. I mean, there may be some, if you saw that, then that happened. But for one thing, what the poor do is they can't function anymore, or they collapse or something of that nature, they go into receiving, I don't know, what is it, so-called receiving hospital emergency. But in the main, the poor get extraordinarily limited health care. And you can see it from the way we wind up in the statistics. We're not anywhere near number one. We're down there with Slovenia and Cuba and places like that. But listen, I don't want to worry you, Paul, but I'll tell you, GM is talking about cutting pension benefits as
They've
well.
They've already done it for it. I'm already paying extra for my medical care. So what I'm saying is lawyers around the country, it's lawyers and monies. Lawyers, guns, and money. You know they would say.
Lawyers, guns, and money.
Yeah.
He said,
that's
yeah.
what it is. It's all about money now. And you know, if everyone kicked in a quarter, an hour, or more, even the people at Walmart, this country would be solved in a second.
Wait, isn't that a Ted Nugent song?
If they were initiated a draft, that war wouldn't have even started.
I can't even remember. All of a sudden, I'm stuck on it. The guy that did Werewolves of London did Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Oh,
Warren Zevon.
Zevon, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, yes.
Now, one of the things, Paul, is you probably know what the CEO of Ford got in 2006, right, as compensation, Alan Mulally? Yeah.
Wait, can I guess?
Yeah.
Wait, you guess first. Let him guess first.
What do you think, Paul?
I would guess he probably got at least $200
million. No, no.
It was $74
million,
wasn't it?
No, God, no.
Okay.
No. $39 million.
We're both wrong.
Yeah, I mean, this company's going bankrupt, and they're paying this guy $39 million, whereas GM chief executive got about $10 million, Chrysler Group chief executive Tom Lasorda, $5.2 million. So you can, you know, I'll tell you what, these guys, you know, you think, oh, they're the head of these companies. Well, they're doing something wrong. They're, you know, they're operating at a loss. I will run Ford for 25%. I'll do it for $10 million easy. All right.
I love it.
Thank you, Paul. All right. Let's see. I want to hear this. Here's Larry in Jackson, Michigan, formerly the home of our pal Ted Nugent. But no longer. Go ahead, Larry. You're on the air.
I was just inquiring about what you mentioned in a previous show, on your great show, Peter, about Cheney's heart's going to suddenly be hurting him, and they're going to try to put a torch carrier as an incumbent. And is that a scenario that you could see arising?
We're both
a torch carrier.
What's that mean?
Oh, it's the parent here, the next person that they want to be the Republican president of the United States.
Okay, we will masticate that one.
Yeah, I'm going to have to think about that one.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
We're going to ponder.
All right, here is...
Cheney does have the bad heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's fearful...
The old ticker.
...of electronic assassination. Remember that?
No.
They're afraid that someone will hit him with a device that will, because he has a pacemaker in there.
Right.
Yeah, that's why, like they built, well, they never did find out.
He's thought of everything, hasn't he?
In 2001, there was all this construction going on. He lives in the Naval Observatory, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that like contemplating your belly button? The Naval, but that's the name. But, There was, pardon me, 24-hour-a-day construction inside of the, you know, big, you know, like drilling. And,
yeah.
And, of course, because Cheney does everything in secret, contradicting the principles of open government. And we haven't even talked about any of that. But in any event, they never did find out what he was doing underneath there. They thought that he may have been building tunnels. That so he could go underneath, that he just would walk underneath.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Of course he probably was.
So that he didn't have to worry about Vice President Snarly.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at some of the stuff on the board here. Where are we here? Let's go to Conrad. Conrad is in Melvindale. Hi, Conrad. You're on the air. Yep, that's not Conrad's line. Hi, Conrad. You're on the line. You're on the air.
Good evening to both of you.
Thank you.
Good evening.
I like the show. Every once in a while when I'm, you know, at home, so Sunday night.
Great.
Being able to listen to it, I, you know, catch as much as I can. In a couple of days, I'm going to lose my job.
Wow.
Sorry.
And it is moving on to the East Coast. Yeah, I work for a major supermarket here in metropolitan Detroit, which is moving out of Michigan.
You mean the headquarters or what?
No, all the stores are closing down, shutting down.
This is like Kroger.
No. It's the one that Kroger's is buying up. They bought 20 stores. They're pulling everything out of Michigan, and I kind of blame it on some of the health care costs.
Oh, that's what I meant, Farmer Jack.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so Farmer Jack is closing at the corner of 696 and Coolidge.
They're closing all 66 of them that are left.
Oh, man.
And they're going out to the East Coast. But you know what? is weird because they just got done buying a chain of grocery stores out on the East Coast in Pennsylvania and New Jersey for $679 million.
Wow.
And from what I understand, they may change the name to Farmer Jack's.
Wow.
Coming soon to the East Coast.
Yeah, so again, these guys with these great financial schemes, how they can provide their investors with a greater return on their investment, they just throw in the basket, in the trash, really, people's lives, people, you know, the community's access to you know, food, and, oh, man.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, good luck to you.
There was some people, you know, that have to walk up to these local stores and stuff like that. Now that they'll be closed down, they won't be able to do that.
This is all. See, this is when I, now I'm being. Let me announce. I'm being facetious. This is all Jennifer Granholm's fault, according to you know, some people, right? No, it's
well,
not.
You can blame it on that, and you can blame it on it's
Peter,
not just the economy.
But,
you know, when somebody like the utility companies, they raise the utilities up 70%. So, can you imagine what it costs to heat and cool these big buildings?
Yeah.
That people walk around in, and you know, buy their groceries, and you know they expect them to be air conditioned down to 70 degrees or heated up to 85 degrees in the wintertime.
Well, you know, I don't think any of that is really the issue. I mean, certainly that costs something. But what's happening that rather than our economies, our local economies being strengthened, that they're all being weakened, and that is what I said. We talk, you know, we hear about more and more layoffs, more and more companies moving, and at the same time, this the wealth increases for the upper echelons. Something's wrong here, to be sure. All right, thank you, Conrad.
Yes, and good luck.
Good luck.
Yes.
Absolutely, good luck. All right, here, this is something interesting. Let me get this. Here is Paul. Paul, and were you just on the air?
For a second I was, I think.
What do you mean? Weren't we talking to you before?
No, you were talking to... Paul in Commerce.
Okay.
I'm up
ahead.
In Oxford.
Oh, yeah, you're in Oxford. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Sorry, I'm catching my breath. I just ran up a couple flights of stairs. anyways, you guys talked about a lot of things, but what I wanted to comment on, I heard you saying that a woman in a wheelchair was...
turned away.
She was turned away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Michigan, it's actually... You cannot be denied health care because you can't pay your bill.
Well, you know, I know that, but, I mean, she could go to an emergency room. I mean, they move people, you know, there's public hospitals. But she didn't have, like, a life-threatening condition. She wanted to see a doctor. And you can't walk into any doctor and he'll say, well, who's your health carrier? And you say, I don't have one. And you say, what's wrong? You say, I have an upset stomach. And, I have a recurring upset stomach. They won't take you. And they're not required to take you because, I mean, if you go in there and you're about to die, yeah. You know,
I guess it depends on the condition. I mean, I didn't hear what you say, what she had wrong with her.
I don't know. I don't know what she had wrong with her.
Yeah, but in Michigan, you can't be denied health care because, you know, you simply you
sure.
don't have insurance or they say you can't pay the bill. And
well, I suspect that's true in any state. But, again, yeah, I don't think you can just go in there with common ailments. All right, that's important. I actually will try to look up that statute and see what conditions prevail. Well, all right, thanks for tipping me off to that. I appreciate it. All right, let's see if we can get some calls pretty quickly. Here is Matt in Detroit. Matt, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Did I do this wrong again? Yeah, I did. Sorry. Right, wait a minute.
I think you did it right.
Yeah, Matt went bye-bye.
Went bye-bye.
All right, yeah. Here is Carl. Carl's in Dearborn Heights. Carl, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
How are you?
Yeah, good.
I was just thinking in the city of Detroit and our economy with the automotive industry, who are union strong, and I work for a union I will not mention on the air, but, you know, it seems like these unions cross lines as far as the entertainment industry.
What do you mean?
I mean, you know... We can't,
are they having their meetings at Trump's or what? Just kidding.
Yeah, tell me quick, because we're almost out of time.
You know, I'm sorry. I'll have to let you go.
All right. I was thinking the same thing, to tell you the truth.
Was it my joke?
No, I think he was getting confused by the fact that he was... that he would hear his voice coming back at him.
Oh, right.
Here's John in Sterling Heights. John, hi. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm doing good.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell you about AT&T.
All right.
I won't be calling you no more because AT&T just tripled my rates.
Really?
What?
Oh, yeah. Now that they formed this new monopoly here in Michigan, they sent me a letter out last week. They said, we're tripling your rates. Everything I have is triple.
Wow.
And there's not a thing I can do about it. Oh, yeah, I can just quit, you know, but... The thing I wanted to tell people about the iPhone, if you buy
Wait, John. You're talking about your, what they call now, a landline, right?
My landline and my, everything I have as far as international and long distance.
Well,
everything's tripled.
Get a cell phone.
I'm looking into it. I just don't have the time right now. But here,
use a phone card.
I want to tell you about the iPhone real quick. If you buy an iPhone from Steve Jobs, you can't buy them at Radio Shack or anyplace else. You got to get them through AT&T. Now, if you hook up with an iPhone, you pay $600. They got you trapped because once you get that iPhone, AT&T starts you off at $60 a month. You got to pay that $60 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guarantee you, in 2 months, 3 months, they're going to have you up to $180.
Well, probably things will go the other way. I mean,
I've read a lot of things about that iPhone.
Yeah,
you know, negative and positive. I won't be getting one.
I'm not going to be getting one.
I just downgraded from the Crackberry to a regular old cell phone.
A Crackberry?
Blackberry.
Oh,
people call it the Crackberry.
Because they're addicted to them?
Yeah.
I don't even have a cell phone.
I know.
Right. Thank you, John.
Bless you.
We gotta go home. But do stay tuned because a couple of interesting interviews coming your way. One with Guy Dawnsey. He's written a book about 101 solutions to cancer, a preventable disease. And this is not, you know, I mean, I say...
It's helpful.
Yeah. It's interesting because you know what? I mean, I say at the beginning of the interview, normally I'd say cancer. I'm turning this off. And then Norman Solomon on his brand new DVD, War Made Easy, which is narrated by Sean Penn.
Yes.
Julian Jordan, thank you so much.
Peter, thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening and calling, and we'll be back next week.
Listening, WRIF.com.
From that someone that is made out of trial, that dare to stand up.
visiting WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Now, don't even come close to pressing another station, and here's why. If I heard that there was going to be a show about cancer, I'd say, I don't want to hear this, and immediately turn it off. It's a dreadful disease. Many of us have contracted it. Almost all of us know someone who has had cancer, and in most ages, there is some dreaded disease, whether it was the plague or leprosy or tuberculosis, and in our age, it's cancer. It's tremendously frightening, and the very concept of it, and many of us feel that it lurks, and it does, as we'll find out. But best of all, and why I say that, you know, don't in despair immediately go, ooh, I don't want to hear about this, because this is a book put out by the Solutions Project. The name of the book is Cancer, 101 Solutions to a Preventable Epidemic. It's written by Liz Armstrong, Guy Dauncey, and Anne Woodworth. And you may remember that I've had Guy Dauncey on before. He's founded the Solutions Project. You may remember him from the book Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Global Climate Change. That was about 5 years ago, so think about how advanced that thinking was. And Guy Dauncey is a futurist and sustainable communities consultant who specializes in developing a positive vision of a post-industrial, environmentally sustainable future. There's a lot there. Welcome back, Guy Dauncey, to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, Peter, I'm delighted to be with you because I really believe that it's very difficult for people watching the television and the news is bad and it's gloom and and people get very depressed and exhausted. So I tend to have this clear idea that only really two problems in the world. One is a long list of all our social, environmental, ecological, political problems from teenagers to taxes to the war in Iraq. The second is the belief that we can't solve them. Because if we then believe that, we become part of the problem. So the message underlying the whole Solutions Project approach is to show in detail just how we can solve our problems, and indeed how many excellent things are already happening by people around the world doing the very things we need to know about.
Well, I like the pronoun, too, although you meant collectively each one of us, and some of these solutions in cancer, 101 solutions to a preventable epidemic, are ones that we can take on ourselves. But a lot of it has to do with we in a community, in a city, in a state, in our nation, in the world, right?
Absolutely. So the way we organize the books, there's 10 solutions for individuals, there's solutions for churches, colleges, schools, solutions for parents with teenagers, and for teenagers rather, solutions for healthcare organizations and for cities, for labor unions, for businesses, for governments, right through to the global level. Because we all, if we really want to get a handle on some of these big solutions like cancer, we all need to tackle this at every level. And what I discovered what we discovered in doing the research is that there are so many things linked to cancer that are preventable because they're not some vague lifestyle thing that just depend on persuading individuals to smoke less and eat better food. They are known carcinogenic contaminants that are getting into our bodies from other products we use, the water we drink, the air we breathe, and didn't ought to be happening. It didn't ought to be happening that we have new, brand new babies coming out of the womb with 230 industrial chemicals in their blood and urine.
Right.
Shouldn't be happening.
Well, yeah, and I was going to ask you about the subtitle of your book, Preventable Epidemic, and I think that's what we're talking about here. But I'll tell you, and maybe you could speak to this a little, looking at the book, which is very attractively done, a very easy to read style, but in there's a yellow strip across the front, and then in black letters it says cancer, and even looking at the word gives me a little discomfort. Well, because I guess people, you know, we think of cancer as the body attacking itself, and there's that that at least, you know, kind of strikes a deep chord of fear in me. Do you look at all, or can you speak to the sort of individual psychological perceptions of this epidemic?
Well, it certainly brings up fear. It certainly brings up alarm. Back in the year 1900, one person in 25 got cancer. In 1950, it was one in five. In 1960, it was one in four. Today, it's one woman in three and almost one man in two. So something's been creeping up on us. And this is, even when you take into account the fact that we're living longer, so there's more opportunity for us to get more diseases, there's been a net increase in most of the cancers. The only one we're getting control of is lung cancer, because we're finally learning that it's not smart to smoke.
Yes.
But the reason why people feel a bit overwhelmed by it is because all of the attention from most of the cancer societies and in the media has been this belief that it's a twofold message. A, that we don't know what's causing it, so we've got to spend all this money on research. And secondly, that somehow the individual is responsible. If somehow you did something wrong, you ate the wrong food, or you got overweight, or didn't exercise, it's your fault. And what we're finding is things like with prostate cancer, which is very common, you know, among men now, that if the mother, while you were in the mother's womb, while she was pregnant with you, if your mother was exposed to a chemical called bisphenol A, which is used to soften plastics, that can increase your likelihood to have cancer 60 years later.
Hmm.
This is totally outside your control, and it shows that, you know, what are we doing allowing pregnant mothers to be contaminated by these chemicals? Where are our regulators? Why is the government not protecting us? Why has this gone wrong? And so those are the questions we address, and we look at the best policies that can be brought in by governments. We look at why governments not bring in these assets, and what we can do as individuals.
Well, here's a conservative listening, and he says, Guy Dunce, he's another one of these nanny state guys. He wants the government to protect us from cancer. Let's have a little individual reliance. How would you respond to
it's
that?
It's very difficult. I mean, when cholera was an epidemic, the discovery of the origins of cholera were to do with the pollution of our water supplies, and all the drinking wells in London that people were drinking from were polluted basically with, you know, human feces. And so it took government intervention to close down the wells that were causing the problem. Individuals, there wasn't any bottled water in those days. We needed government to act collectively on our behalf. When a brand new baby has 230 chemicals going into its blood when it's born, how can the baby take responsibility for that if those chemicals later make it caught, have it, you know, being more susceptible to cancer? It's just nonsense to think that individuals can solve the whole problem. But your listener's absolutely right in a certain regard. There's a lot that we can do as individuals. And for people just to expect, oh, the government solved this, I can go on eating junk food and I don't need to bother exercise, I'll just watch TV and eat hot dogs. Absolutely correct. We need more personal responsibility about the food we eat and the way we, you know, exercise and the way we don't smoke. So he's right, and I'm right too.
Guy Dunce, in your book, there must have been a genesis of this. What thrust you towards this? Was there any personal experience, or was this?
No, Peter, I've not had cancer. Not got cancer in my family. I'd just done the book on climate change, looking at 101 solutions to global climate change. Again, what individuals can do and what others can do. And people were saying, this is such a good approach with the way you're laying it out, just two pages per solution. It's clear, it's easy. And I thought, why do I stop at climate change? Why don't I take on more issues? So I launched the Solutions Project. This is the third book in our series. We've got another one coming out this fall called Building an Ark, 101 Solutions to Animal Suffering.
Uh-huh.
And I'm hoping we'll have one on the 101 Solutions to Homelessness soon. And we just last summer had a book out called Enough Blood Shed, 101 Solutions to Violence, Terror, and War. And so I actually was triggered to do the cancer thing by reading a book by Sandra Steingraber, who is a wildlife biologist and a poet who was living in Illinois and had cancer, bladder cancer as a teenager, and then another cancer later on. And her mother had cancer, her sisters had cancer, her aunts had cancer. But she was adopted, so there was nothing genetic going on. And it was the common environment she shared in the Illinois farmland that basically was polluting her, and she'd actually tracked her bladder cancer to the polluted water they were drinking, with chemicals runoff from pesticides and from treatments in the water that shouldn't be happening.
There's so many carcinogenic triggers in our environment, and
that's so true, Peter.
We should talk a little about that. But and it actually pulled me up a little short there, because I was just about to make the statement at some point that if you put an industrial map and a cancer map of the United States, or since you're in Canada, of North America, they're identical. But obviously, it's beyond just industrial areas. But I mean, things that where there's really heavy concentration, like in what do they call that? That area down in Louisiana and East Texas. There's so is that true? Is an industrial map and a cancer map very very similar?
Well, it's the industry happens where humans settle and where there's higher human populations, and it's so that industrial map shows greater concentrations of settlement, more cars, more air pollution, more of everything going on. So it's hard to sort it out and blame it fully on industry, because there are so many contaminants out there, and cancer takes so long to develop in our bodies. I mean, obviously for children, if you have childhood cancer, it doesn't take long to develop, and that's been increasing throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, increasing by 1% per year. And we do know that in the farmland areas, farmers and their wives who handle pesticides are more likely to get cancers associated with that. But I mean, certainly in the areas around chemical plants, there's more disease, there's more illness. In Windsor, Ontario, where we have the highway coming through from Detroit, which is just truck after truck after truck after truck after truck.
Yeah.
And they're all pumping out diesel into the air. And yes, for Windsor, there are higher health alarm bells ringing. And we know that diesel fumes are packed full of nasty chemicals, many of which are known links to cancer. And so it's interesting. Last year, Dana Reeves, do you remember the wife of Superman?
Oh, yeah.
She died from lung cancer.
She did.
And she'd never smoked. She'd never smoked. And the media attention was entirely on, well, it must be caused by radon coming up from underneath our houses, because there's a very small contribution from radon. They wouldn't touch the issue of air pollution and diesel fumes, which are far more likely to be a cause of that lung cancer, because smoking only causes 80% of our lung cancers. And indeed, some smokers actually never get lung cancer because of the genetic variability we have.
Most of them don't, as a matter of fact.
Most smokers don't get lung cancer?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, they don't know.
Well, okay, that's. I'll have to track into that one.
Okay. Well, I think it's. I think, in fact, a relatively small percentage. I mean,
now you put me on the spot. That's fascinating.
Well, think about this. Hundreds of throughout the world, hundreds of millions of people smoke, and probably 50 million people in this country smoke. I mean, the nicotine, yeah. the and all of that is the tars are a genetic trigger. Or trigger the genetic predisposition towards it. I mean, yeah, so if you don't get cancer, you just get increased heart risk.
Yeah, it's other diseases.
Emphysema. Yeah, no, it's terrible. Yeah, we all know that.
But there is a proven connection.
Absolutely.
From smoking to lung cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to stop you there. Guy Dauncey is my guest. He has co-authored Cancer, 101 Solutions to a Preventable Epidemic. You know, it's very interesting when people write in a prescient manner, and you did so with Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Global Climate Change. You were talking about this years ago. I was going to say, in the same manner, Rachel Carson, her book was, what, was that early 60s?
1962, her book came out.
Silent Spring. And so we've known this, right?
It's awful. I mean, she was alarmed in 1962 because one person in four was getting cancer, and she said there's a globally pervasive epidemic we're causing. Specifically, she was referring to pesticides, where everyone around the planet has traces of pesticides in their bodies. And now it's one in three for women, and as I said earlier, almost one in two for men. And the known links to pesticides still continue. Now, luckily, we've done a lot of good things since Rachel Carson's work, but we brought a lot of new products onto the market that we didn't know about before. And with a lot of things we've not changed on. We have not changed the way we're degrading the quality of the food we eat. It's still lacking in nutrients. A 50% fall since 1950 in the levels of iron, calcium, sodium, copper, magnesium, selenium in our food, because chemical fertilizers interfere with the way plants take up nutrients from the soil, and they also stop the soil being rebuilt with organic material from leaf mulch and compost and manure and seaweed and stuff like that. And So we're actually we're weakening ourselves at two levels. One is by our food not giving us the nutrients we need, and secondly is by our bodies being, you know, contaminated with known carcinogenic chemicals and with radiation from nuclear power and from electromagnetic fields and cell phones and things like that.
And, you know, it's interesting. I said at the beginning of the show that I didn't, you know, that this was about solutions, and well that it is. But what is troubling is that we have to pay so much attention. We have to all of a sudden defend ourselves very consciously in a manner that we should be able to just, you know, we should be able to eat and not worry about it. We should be able to breathe the air, drink the water.
You should be able to use cosmetics without worrying about them. We shouldn't have to. We should be able to use nail varnish without worrying about them. And we can't. We do need to worry about those things because there's been a failure of the regulatory system. There's been constant resistance against good regulations that would get these things out of here. I mean, Sweden is bringing in a plan for the whole nation to eliminate all hazardous chemicals by the year 2020.
Really?
And their equivalent in America actually is Massachusetts, which brought in really good legislation back in 1990 called the Toxics Use Reduction Act. And this, interestingly, it came about as a compromise because there were some environmental groups who said they wanted to eliminate the really hazardous chemicals from Massachusetts. And the Chamber of Commerce said, "Oh, mate, if you do that, our industry will just move to New Jersey and we're going to be stuck and we'll just lose them and nothing will change." So they sat down for a compromise and they wrote the Toxics Use Reduction Act. This requires all businesses that use chemicals to pay a small fee on them, which goes to an outfit called the Toxics Use Reduction Institute, linked to the University of Massachusetts. And the industries are required also to plan how to reduce their toxins and also to cost out what that would involve. And the institute helps them do that by providing green chemistry advice. When they look at the costings, their accountant says, "My goodness, this is going to save us a lot of money." And so they proceed to do the planning to reduce their toxins. And since in the year, in just 10 years from 1990 to 2000, Massachusetts' largest industries have reduced their release of carcinogenic chemicals to the environment by a full 76%.
Wow.
While making money in the process. So we know that it can be done, and we know that industry can carry on being successful, employing people, generating what it needs for its shareholders without poisoning the rest of us. So why don't we just do it for the whole country?
Yeah, it would be good. Cancer is the book, 101 Solutions to a Preventable Epidemic. It's published by the Solutions Project, and Guy Dauncey, one of the co-authors, who's the founder of the Solutions Project, is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. It's published by New Society Publishers. NewSociety.com is the website. Also at my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, there'll be a link as well. I never liked to rank order things in my life, but let me see if you will. If there was one of the 101 solutions that would be the absolute most important, or is it? Do we have to go at all of them?
We have to go at all of them because, I mean, clearly, I would say that if we look at it in the big picture, the one solution that's most valuable, well, the two, the one would be to do as Sweden is doing and plan to phase out all of the hazardous chemicals, and the second would be to plan a total transition to fully organic farming for the whole nation, because there is evidence that organic food actually contains compounds that actively protect us against cancer. The reason they do that, this is antioxidants and new compound called salvestrols that's just going through clinical trials as to its efficiency. The reason they do this is that plants have evolved over millions of years, obviously. Unless they could be successful, they can't pass their seeds on. They're attacked by fungus all the time, and they have a natural way to defend themselves against fungus by generating these compounds called salvestrols. When we eat them, they trigger a process that attacks any cancer cell directly without harming anything else in the body. But when we don't grow food organically, so that the plants in the fields are sprayed with fungicides, the plants shrug their shoulders and say, "Well, I don't need to waste energy to protecting myself because I'm not even meeting any fungus." And so we're artificially preventing the plants from developing their immune systems. It's a bit like parents who are so careful about baby. They wash the sheets every day and clean the floor and polish everything with antibacterial soaps. The baby never develops an immune system because it's never exposed to germs. As soon as it goes to daycare, it's sick with everything under the sun.
Well, the other thing, of course, about growing food non-organically is the persistence of pesticides and herbicides and everything else under the sun that winds up in our environment and, as you
Correct.
Indicated, hurts the people that are the most directly connected to it. But then it's also absorbed into the food itself. I think Cuba is a good example that they got yanked unceremoniously off of the Western mode of growing with pesticides and herbicides back when the Soviet Union collapsed, and they've done just incredible with organic farming and gardening.
Yes. It'd be interesting, and I haven't seen this study, it'd be interesting to know if there's a study going on Cuba's cancer rates and how much difference that is making to them, the fact that they're now getting more organic food. We do know that, you know, studies consistently since 1975 have shown that farmers develop and die of more cancers than the general population, even though they get more fresh air and exercise than most of us. And we do know that modern farming leaves these cancer-causing residues from pesticides on many apples, peppers, cherries, celery, grapes, etc., etc. And that's one reason why, especially parents, there's a huge movement towards organic baby food, because parents say, well, at least I can protect my children. And when I have the first baby food, we make that organic, because purely using what we call the precautionary principle, you know, it makes sense. We protect children from fire. We protect children from falling downstairs. We protect children from falling in the bathtub. We need to protect them against these chemicals as well with just the same level of love.
Yeah, you, on the back of the book, it says How to Prevent Cancer Before It Starts. You don't have any argument, or do you, with research into cures for cancer?
No. We just haven't tackled the process of going into this, and that there are so many books published on this, and there are so many different approaches, like in addition to the regular chemotherapy and surgery and radiation. There are so many claims for different diets, some of which are definitely successful and some maybe less so. It's just not a territory we wanted to touch. I'm not trained medically. I haven't got the expertise to talk about that, but I am able to research into the science and the background of this and pull together this evidence and information, and really all, I'm drawing on other people's work the whole time. So one of the people whose work I draw on is Dr. Richard Clapp,
mm-hmm.
who's put together with colleagues a major database called Environmental and Occupation Causes of Cancer. When they look through all of the research and they put the studies together and they put a whole report together, for instance, you know, they know that bladder cancer is linked by peer-reviewed studies to arsenic in drinking water, to chlorination byproducts, to solvents, especially among dry cleaning workers, to hair dyes, to petrochemicals, metalworking fluids, etc. And for all the cancers, they've got a list of all the studies that show the links to environmental contamination and to radiation.
Yeah. Well, I was looking through the 101 solutions to a preventable epidemic, which is cancer. Number 96 is ban asbestos, and I thought that had been solved. Interestingly, you say on page 258, the first miners began to dig out asbestos in 1879 at Thetford, Quebec. Right near Thetford, there's a town you may be aware of called Asbestos. That's the name of the town. Asbestos, Quebec, which I had the misfortune of going through, where they still have like 40-foot piles of asbestos tailings in the middle of town.
And Canada is I'm ashamed of my own country here, because the Canadian government still supports the production of asbestos there.
Really?
Yes,
wow.
Still in production. It's basically they ship it overseas. They ship it to India and Pakistan.
Oh, well, what the hell?
And they claim that it's a safer kind of asbestos and that the workers are going to have protection. Well, hello. I mean, in India, you see people, you know, they make, you know, roofing tiles out of the asbestos, and there are workers with saws cutting them up with no protection whatsoever. You know, and it's a 20-30 delay until you get the very horrible form of cancer known as mesothelioma. And we just need to ban asbestos entirely globally. There is a big global movement to try and ban asbestos, but Canada is one of the global pariahs that insists on carrying on doing it. It's just protecting jobs, you know.
True. Well, the last book we talked with you about, Guy Donzi, was Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Global Climate Change, and you were way in the front of our realization that we're confronting a problem. Were you pleased to see that there were solutions that were actually have begun to be utilized, the kind of ones you suggested?
Yes. I mean, I'm still fully engaged in that matter. I'm actually here where I live in Canada. I'm president of the BC Sustainable Energy Association, so I'm still very engaged in the whole issue of climate change. And it is satisfying to see that people are picking up on the very solutions we talked about. And there is a lot of, just in the last 6 months in particular, a huge sea change in the way the world understands that the deniers have really become a bit like the flat earthers of the Middle Ages now. The people have said that, well, they insist that the sun goes around the earth because you can see it going around the earth every day. The science is so solid, and the book stands up extremely well because those solutions are now being, you know, put into place, but the urgency of it is cannot be underestimated. I mean, this is another interview, Peter, for another day, but it is the scientists who are closest to the science on climate change who are ringing the alarm bells the most loudly. And I'm close to the science, and I know just how alarming it is that we need to move really quickly to a full energy transition away from fossil fuels. And actually, the same transition would tackle cancer also, because a lot of the origins of the chemicals lie with the ability that fossil fuels gives us to do quick and easy chemistry by smashing and bashing chemicals, which produces a lot of toxic offshoots, instead of what's known as green chemistry, which is the way nature does chemistry, with fewer core compounds and much more sophisticated intelligent architecture. And then things like, obviously, when you eliminate the use of fossil fuels and you move to electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, you're eliminating the air quality problems, you're also eliminating the noise in our cities, and there's a surplus, a global available surplus of solar energy, wind energy, geothermal energy, ocean energy from tide and wave, and being much more from efficiency.
Well,
it's a vision of a sustainable society that actually is really enchanting
and exciting, rather than fear of
that's
it all.
Very much so.
Fear of climate change, fear of cancer. There are solutions. The book is Cancer: 101 Solutions to a Preventable Epidemic. It was put together by Guy Dauncey, who the founder of the Solutions Project, who has put this book out along with Liz Armstrong and Ann Woodsworth. It's available from New Society Publishers, newsociety.com. Also a link on my site, peterwerby.com. Guy Dauncey, as usual, thanks for joining me on the program.
It's been my pleasure, Peter.
Weekday nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with the big unit. Every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. You know, documentaries have really made their entry into the public consciousness in a big way. In many ways, we have Michael Moore to thank for it, including his brand new one, Sicko. But there are so many other people that have brought issues to our attention, and I've interviewed several of those people over the last couple of months. It's a pleasure, though, to bring back to the Peter Werby Show someone who is an old friend who's been on this program any number of times. In fact, I'm positive that we did an interview on the book that has become a documentary. On June 21st, the Media Education Foundation released a powerful new documentary. It's called War Made Easy. It's an indictment of the dishonesty that has accompanied U.S. military intervention since the Vietnam War. It's narrated by Sean Penn, the actor, and it's based on Norman Solomon's acclaimed book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. And Norman Solomon is a nationally syndicated columnist on media and politics, author of numerous books. He's the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, which is a national consortium of policy researchers and analysts, and one that I use very frequently. And Norman Solomon is out in San Francisco. We're reaching him at his office. Norman, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, Peter.
Well, you're excited? This is your first documentary, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I'm a sometimes radio guy and definitely writer with words on the computer screen and the page, and it's a whole new thing for me to see the book transported into the world of video, and the most exciting dimension of it to me is the reach down into the Orwellian memory hole. This is footage that goes back 30, 40, 50 years, and it explodes the memory, the popularized mythology that, for instance, just to pick a name out of a hat, Walter Cronkite, right?
Sure.
People think, oh, what a courageous journalist. He blew the whistle on the Vietnam War. Absolutely wrong. We have footage in the film from 1965 where Walter Cronkite is in Vietnam, and he's palling around with a high-level officer. He's coming down from a jet bomber and saying what a wonderful instrument of war it is. And it's pretty stunning to just see the footage because nobody can argue with it. There it is, in that case, in black and white.
But Norman Solomon, people would say, listening would say, well, what's wrong with that? Wait a minute. This is U.S. war. It's U.S. troops, the U.S. newsman. And what's inherently wrong with that?
Well, if you want to be a cheerleader, just get the pom-poms, but don't call yourself a journalist. Or if you want to cheerlead the government, maybe you want to try to get an appointment from the latest administration in Washington. But if you're going to call yourself a journalist, then you ought to be independent, you ought to be assertive, you ought to raise tough questions, and not just do stenography or production for the war makers in Washington.
Well, you know I agree with that, but let me be the devil's advocate just a little bit.
Sure.
Many of my listeners often think I am in any event, but if you or I, if Norman Solomon or Peter Werby, embedded journalist, don't you think we would keep our same criticality? Wouldn't it be the same Norman Solomon and Peter Werby that was able to look maybe even closer at all of the events that we're reporting on?
Well, the film actually goes into the question of the embedded journalist process, which, of course, came to its heyday with the invasion and then occupation of Iraq. And contrary to the myth that somehow it gave people a close-in critical view of the war, it actually was a way in which correspondents bonded with the troops. And the result, with very few exceptions, was that we, as listeners, viewers, and readers back in the United States, saw the war overwhelmingly through the eyes of the invaders, not those being invaded. We saw it through the eyes of the occupiers, not those whose country was being occupied. And so it's a way in which the news media becomes, so to speak, more the fourth estate, selling out and becoming a de facto fourth branch of government.
Mm-hmm. And also, that as interesting as some of that footage may have been, what we care about as American citizens, trying to make a judgment about what's going on in any situation, let alone war, where lives and tax dollars are being expended, is what are the issues, not the pathos of or the bravery or what have you. Not to say that that's not a human component we may want to examine, but ultimately we wanted to know, was this legitimate? What were all the things that the neoconservatives promised would occur? Finding weapons of mass destruction, being welcomed, all, you know, all of that hoorah that it took us too long to find out about. That's what was the issue, not that you know, Jim Smith from Elmira, Ohio, and how he felt about being in Iraq, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, really, the whole coverage from Washington was a colossal botch, and not by happenstance or laziness, but because of the reliance on official sources, journalists trained and often edited to give undue credit and credence and trust to pronouncements coming from places like the White House and the Pentagon. You know, when it comes to the war coverage itself, yeah, we do want to. Let's say somebody comes from Detroit or wherever, they've volunteered, they're in the military, their family is worrying back home. That's a legitimate story, but when the story of the pathos and the anguish is focused so much on the U.S. military and those who are dropping the bombs, and so little on the people who are at the receiving end of the bombs, then you get a distorted picture of even who is suffering in the war. And then when you get to policy, the way in which the media in the United States were so trusting of journalists who were in turn trusting of top officials made it a kind of a circle of mendacity.
Let's talk some about the film itself. My guest is Norman Solomon on the Peter Werby Show, and the documentary is called War Made Easy. It's from Norman's book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Kept Spinning Us to Death. Well, Norman, I know you know that many fictional authors are just aghast at what Hollywood has done to their films and when it's presented in the cinema. How did you feel about the transformation from the written page where you spend so much effort on and having it appear as a documentary?
I've been really lucky because the film was done by a nonprofit outfit called the Media Education Foundation. They spent a year and a half with meticulous searching for footage, for documentation. And it's very true to the book with an added dimension of seeing the reporters and the correspondents and the pundits, as well as presidents from LBJ and Nixon to the current occupant of the White House. And the way it's been edited together is just really powerful. And I just count my lucky stars that it's been in such capable cinematic hands.
How were you able to get such a high-powered star as Sean Penn to do the narration?
Well, I met him when we both went to Iraq together in December of 2002, which, as it turned out, was 3 months before the invasion of Iraq. And I he didn't know me from Adam, was very friendly and, of course, very worried about the war on the horizon. It turned out he was very prophetic. And so we've stayed in touch and done various projects together. And when the film was being edited, with some trepidation, because I know how extremely busy he is, I asked if he would narrate it, and he didn't miss a beat. He said, you know, I'd be glad to. And he not only did it, but he did it with a donation of his time and his voice and his name.
Well, that's right. In fact, I remember I interviewed you when you came back from Iraq, and you told us about your trip and the trip with Sean Penn. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of this broadcast that Michael Moore has really opened the door to critical mass marketing of DVDs. And I wonder if you could speak to that a little. I mean, if you would have tried to put this out 5 years ago, you probably would have had the same success that I had on my nationally syndicated talk show, whereas no one wanted to hear any criticism of the current administration or impending wars or all the rest of the stuff now that is a lot more open for. Do you see yourself as part of a wave?
Well, I think there is much more openness to documentary film, and I think critically, and you're referring to this, I think, as well, the political climate really makes a big difference, and that's sort of the bad news and the good news. The bad news is that when you or I, with you as a radio talk show host or a writer, we are really swimming upstream because the conventional wisdom is, hey, you got to go with the flow. It's a wartime. War is good. War is patriotic. It's very tough to make headway. But now the results of the deception have become so clear. Most of the country has swung against this war. A lot of the chameleon journalists have said that the war is not good. And so it gives us an opportunity, you know, as they say, it's a teachable and learnable moment where we can see that this is a deeper pattern. It's not just this war. It's going back one decade after another, patterns of deception, people in Washington using the press, being used by the press to drag this country into one war after another.
By the way, people, you can go to the website for the film and find more about it. You can go to warmadeeasy.org, warmadeeasy.org, and I'll have a link on my site as well. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. Now, why just 50 years? I mean, you could have gone back to the Spanish-American War. That was another war based on deception. And also the U.S. entry into World War One was based on deception as well. But in fact, let me just say, I often say to people, why did the United States enter World War One? And you can hear a pin drop in a room, right? Because most Americans have no idea whatsoever. But both those wars were also deceptive reasoning. Why did you limit it?
Well, I certainly want to say I agree. I mean, the World War One was a horrific war, totally unnecessary just for financial and absurd pseudo-patriotic reasons. 1898, the attack on the Philippines, horrible. The reason I went back only 50 years, one reason is that I'm 55 years old, and it was stuff that I could remember, the Vietnam War going forward, but also that really the Vietnam War was a huge sort of a bellwether and led us into this direction of after World War II intervention that was justified with incredible media spin that turned out to be false.
Well, you know, when I bring up to people that Vietnam and Grenada and the invasion of Panama, the first Gulf War, were similarly, and this is the theme of War Made Easy, your documentary, that most it was either completely on fabricated pretenses or pretty much so, doesn't seem to raise much concern.
Well, it's a tough sled, you know, and the film and the book Were Made Easier really focused on that these historical patterns repeat themselves. You know, even during the Vietnam War, people would say sometimes, oh, this is a terrible war, but it's an anomaly, it's an aberration. We still hear that now, that, well, George W. Bush, he's so terrible, we don't usually have our country doing these things, lying us into war. I would beg to disagree. I think if you look at every single war, beginning with the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964 and the entry full force into the Vietnam War, from that day to this, we've had one war after another, and you mentioned quite a few of them, where on the surface people were eager to believe all too often, hey, this is a righteous war. When you look at the evidence, it's quite the opposite.
Well, give us some examples. I think, fortunately, over the last few years, we've begun to learn the truth about the origins of the Vietnam War. But just like they've listed the family jewels of the CIA, literally the crimes that have violated their charter and violated the laws of the United States, it's going to be the same thing. 30, 40 years from now, they're going to be, our grandkids or whatever are going to be told, oh, the CIA in the first part of the 21st century. Bring us back maybe to the beginning of the Vietnam War. Where does the deception lie there?
Well, in early 1964, there were reports in the U.S. news media that were seized upon by President Johnson, because his administration was the source of those reports, that unprovoked attacks by the North Vietnamese had occurred against U.S. ships in the Gulf of Tonkin off of Vietnam. And within a matter of a few days, the closest that we ever got to a congressional declaration of war on Vietnam was passed in Congress precisely because of those deceptive reports that were generated from the Johnson administration. And really, I say in the film that when I pressed the Washington Post to find out if they ever retracted their false reporting on the Gulf of Tonkin, I was led to Murray Marder, who was their diplomatic correspondent, reported on the Tonkin Gulf at the time, and I said, why wasn't there ever a retraction? And he said, well, if the U.S. news media were going to retract its reporting on the Gulf of Tonkin, it would need to retract its reporting on virtually the entire Vietnam War, which
wow.
Tells you something. And then you fast forward, the invasion of Grenada in 83 and Panama 89 to a large degree, both were predicated on the idea that U.S. citizens were in danger there and needed to be rescued. Absolute hogwash. The deployment of 250,000 U.S. troops to the Persian Gulf in late 1990 after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, predicated by the first George W. Bush or first George Herbert Walker Bush on the idea that the Iraqi troops were a threat to invade Saudi Arabia. We know from satellite photos that was a lie.
Before you, let me just stop you there because, I mean, I know there's a long list, but that it was the invasion of Iraq that time was called Operation Desert Storm, right? But what preceded that was Operation Desert Shield. Troops were going to be sent there, as you said, Norman Solomon, to stop the Iraqi invasion of Saudi Arabia, which was pure fabrication.
Yeah, it was bunkum, but it sold really well in August of 1990, and the way it was sold was, well, we have to make sure Saudi. And what they did is they did a bait and switch on us. Once the troops are there, well, then there are all those ships in the Persian Gulf, and one thing led to another, and this will not stand, is what the first President Bush said. But the verdict of the U.S. media was that was a wonderful war. And in fact, the Pentagon quietly said that 100,000 Iraqis had been killed in a six-week period in early 1991. And yet that war then as now was chalked up by the punditocracy as a wonderful success.
Well, there's probably a lot of our listeners that either had relatives, maybe themselves, served in Vietnam. An enormous amount of people went through that meat grinder, and also the Gulf War as well. So Norman Solomon is saying all of what they experienced, all of their sacrifice was based on deception?
It was based on deception, and that takes nothing away from the courage and the bravery of people who were sent there and did what they understood to be their duty. The film ends with a audio track from Martin Luther King Jr., and he talks about how difficult it is for people to challenge their own government, particularly in times of war. But as he points out, when you have a society year after year spending more on the military than on social uplift, then that society, as Dr. King put it, is approaching spiritual death. And here we are in a country now spending almost $2 billion a day on the military. And you can walk around any city in this country, not just in Michigan, but around the United States, you will find health care, education, housing, nutrition in short supply for millions of people, and yet the Pentagon budget is bloated.
Yeah, it is. War Made Easy is the documentary, and we're talking with Norman Solomon, and the film is narrated by Sean Penn. You can go to warmadeeasy.org. If this is I don't know why, maybe I've been watching too many talk shows myself, Norman, but if you had to put a double feature of documentaries, what would you pair it with? I was thinking Why We Fight as the double bill with War Made Easy.
Yeah, I think you could also go back to a documentary that was made probably 25 years ago about the great journalist I.F. Stone called I.F. Stone's Weekly. And he was the non-journalist of today. He was the counter of the blow-dried that we see on cable news. I.F. Stone was a tough journalist. He asked questions. He didn't pal around with top officials in Washington. He was their adversary. And I think that that's something that is so sorely lacking and we need to encourage.
Now, I haven't seen the video yet, but I'm looking forward to it. And you, I don't know, maybe I should not keep bringing him up, but Michigander Michael Moore, who unlike most documentary makers, is in it quite a bit. That's sort of a new technique. And you are the central person in this film, am I correct?
Well, they interviewed me a bunch, and then they brought in so much archival footage, so I'm sort of an intermittent voice there. I'm not as irreverent, per se, as Moore had been in a film like Roger and Me or Bowling for Columbine. But I have to say it's the historical footage that just is so stunning, and we realize by watching it how much we're missing from our own media.
Now, we've, the documentaries not only are they available as for like home viewing, but very frequently they've been having commercial showing beyond Moore's films, and even some smaller ones like Danny Schechter's Weapons of Mass Destruction, which were shown here in Detroit. Are we expecting War Made Easy to have some commercial showings?
Well, if people go to the website, they click through and they'll see now about 35 different communities are showing it in July and August. And some of those are in theaters, and almost all those are totally the initiative of grassroots people. They're listening to a radio program such as this one. They click through to the website. They get hold of the DVD, and they, in a church or in a public library, they schedule the showing. So we're in a few theaters. We're in a lot more libraries and living rooms, and that's really the model, because even though there's a supposed anti-war media in this country, it's generally very superficial. And I think this film goes a lot deeper. It's a lot tougher. You probably will never see it on a TV network.
Now, I'm blanking on a man's name, but who's produced a number of it. Is it Robert Greenwald? Is that his
name? Yes.
Robert Greenwald, who he created the model, and you sound like this is very similar, of having house parties all across the United States when he did his, did the one on Walmart, and what was the one before that?
Yeah, he did Outfoxed, about the Fox Network.
Oh, that's right.
And it's an important model because we have to get around the bottlenecks, and I'm excited that people are able to not just watch the film, but say, well, I like it. I'm going to show it in my living room. I'm going to show it in my church or whatever.
Yeah, and it is available. I mean, I see you have on your site, you have a way that people can can link into this. Give us an idea of what people would do, because very frequently, let's say that there's an isolated individual, and the system has worked assiduously to keep us isolated, because when we get together, boy, the people start wanting to make the rules instead of the elite. So if someone is listening to this broadcast and they went, well, wait a minute, maybe I could show it to my union local or to my church or my high school or something like that, what would the process be?
Well, they'd get hold of the DVD, and then they would simply go to the website. And if you click through, it's the one that you gave, or there's a more specific one, which is warmadeeasythemovie.org. And there's all kinds of things you can download in terms of literature, guidance for how to set up your own screening. Whether it's for 8 people in your living room or 500 people in a mega church, you have then the power to do that. It's really up to you. It's a DVD process, and the sky's the limit.
Isn't that really what it's all about, though, is us coming together? The Internet has been very valuable, and obviously it's aiding you in promoting the documentary War Made Easy. But ultimately, we've got to come together in the flesh, see one another, function as a community or as groups or as religious grouping, whatever it is, whatever brings us together, and stop all that isolation.
Absolutely. I think isolation is the key thing that we need to push up against and transcend, because whether we're talking about a war or whether we're talking about media spin, it's our passivity that allows it to continue, and we have to reverse that process.
You know, I was very frequently, we looked for filmmakers to make more films, like Michael Moore. He's made one after another. Like, what do you think? What could he make after Sicko? In fact, I thought that he had kind of come to a dead end. When I heard maybe much as 2 years ago or so that he was going to make a film about healthcare in America, I said, this is not going to fly. And, of course, being the master promoter that Michael is, and Michael being Michael, he's done quite well. And same thing here. I think, what's he going to do next? But it, does Norman Solomon have another one in the works? You've written so many books.
Well, I don't know if I'll ever have a book again made into a film, but I just finished a book that's coming out in the fall, and it deals with the last 50 years of the warfare state, and I get into the culture and the counterculture of a war country that is so imbued with respect for the armaments of violence, with the shadow of the mushroom cloud, and to try to understand how we have been swept away with this warfare state. Well, I'm 55, and in the late 1960s, I was among millions of other people very excited about peace and love rather than war and destruction.
You know, I see we just have about a minute or so left, but one of your quotes from War Made Easy is, if you're pro-war, you're objective. This is the media people. If you're anti-war, you're biased. And is that going to be overcome on the mainstream media, the MSM? I'm a little doubtful. I love media reformers. You know, I've always supported the groups you've been part of, the Institute for Public Accuracy and Fairness and Accuracy in Media. But I'm always a little dubious as the corporate media is ever going to be reformable.
Well, I'm not optimistic, but I'm not fatalistic either. I think there's an addiction to war, an addiction to double standards and Orwellian newspeak, and countless TV network blow-dried correspondents and anchors, they absolutely would never dream of making anti-war statements, but they routinely make pro-war statements, and within the warped definition of what it means to be an American professional journalist, that's considered A-OK.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with me. Barbara Ehrenreich, journalist and author of Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy, a book I heartily recommend, says Solomon is one of the sharpest media watchers in the business. You can see it all on the screen. War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. It's narrated by Sean Penn. Norman Solomon has been my guest on the Peter Werby Show. As always, great to have you on the program, Norman.
Hey, thank you, Peter.
WRIF.com.